Committee is called back to order. Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. First bill on tonight's agenda is Senate File 1341. Senator Olson, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm pleased to be here on behalf of Senate File 1341, which is a bill that the Department of Natural Resources asked me to carry, dealing with how the state chooses to classify data related to licensures. So, for example, if someone gets a fishing license, a hunting license, a boat license, the things, all the licenses that are under the jurisdiction of the DNR. And the reason that this is an issue right now is because the DNR is in the process of transferring how they are storing this data, the system that they're using. And because of that transfer, if we don't do something to act as a legislature, then information that at this point has been private, except for some very specific exceptions that are delineated in a federal law, I believe, then the information will become public. And that would be a fairly large change of policy that we hate to happen just by chance and not make a deliberative decision about how this information should be stored. There are people with interests in this on both directions. I'm the Data Practices Subcommittee Chair, and the way that I've drafted the bill actually probably doesn't make it as quite as private as I would like, because I tend to be of the philosophy that a person's private information should be kept private and not subject to people who want to use it to market, send you marketing things, or use mass mailing or that kind of thing. That's just my philosophy. But I think there are probably some people here who may want to testify who would like to make all of this public information. And so there are definitely differences of opinion. And we do have a couple of amendments drafted, depending on which way this committee decides it would like to go. But that's kind of the question or the choice, is that issue. And to give you some more detail or more specific information, Bob Myers is here to testify on behalf of the DNR.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. The bill before you today is one for awareness and discussion purposes. Our system, our electronic licensing system, we are in the process of upgrading that. It's going to be a state-of-the-art new touchscreen system. Rather than the small little terminals you see at the service stations and sporting good outlets, it'll be a touch screen that'll be interactive. It'll operate a lot more efficiently. We'll be able to upgrade it faster and cheaper. Currently, we take the data. As you give me your driver's license, you go to a Holiday Station down here on University or on 7th Street to buy a fishing license. They say, "Can I see your driver's license?" They take it. They swipe it in the machine. We connect that driver's license or the information on that license to the Department of Public Safety's database. We take that information and then populate our fields, giving us the current information on yourself, your address, your phone number, your height, weight, eye color, things like that. Because of that connection to that DPS database, all of our data from the electronic licensing system is now private due to federal law. That was a change that took place approximately 2.5-3 years ago. Our new system, you will go to the store, purchase a license. They will ask for your driver's license. We will swipe it, and we will take the information that's encoded on the magnetic strip and use that data to populate our database, therefore severing that tie to Department of Public Safety. So now, after March 1st of 2010, our database technically is going to be public. And that includes my information on minors. It will include information on women, men. For all of that data that's in our database will become public. Commissioner Holston, in conversations with the governor's office and others, wanted to make sure that we had a conversation with the legislature on this important issue, because previous to this, when the data was public, data privacy issues weren't what they are today. You know, we all know where data privacy issues have ended up lately. Data privacy is a chief concern for the state government, for the individuals that are in our system as well. So we wanted to make sure that we have a full decision or a discussion, and that the legislature blesses that all of this information is either public or that we do protect some of that. And I appreciate Senator Olson for helping us with this discussion and helping us come before you today with this bill that we've drafted.
What is 84.0874?
That's in the bill, the next section.
Okay, that's the...
Mr. Chair, that's the new section of law that this would be codified under, I believe.
All right. So this data needs to be classified under this as opposed to our other data privacy statutes, because why? Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, just real quickly, the bill before you, you'll see amends in Section 1, Chapter 13, Section 0.7931. It's adding a subdivision stating that electronic licensing system data maintained by the Department of Natural Resources for the purposes of obtaining game and fish license, cross-country ski pass, horse trail pass, snowmobile, sticker, recreational motor vehicle, or any other license transaction are classified. So we're classifying the data under Chapter 13, and then we're creating a new section in Chapter 84 saying that this data is protected and may be released for specific purposes.
Okay. And Chapter 13 is our Data Privacy Act?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. But but it still wouldn't be under the Data Privacy Act anymore under this, because you're just sub-referencing it to the DNR statutes, right? Or cross-referencing it. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair and members, Sheila Deo, Department of Natural Resources, Data Practices Compliance Official.
Mm-hmm.
Section 13.7931 is the place in Chapter 13 that is the place where all DNR data that's classified other than public is referenced. And so then it cross-references into specific language about DNR, which would be Section 84, or Chapter 84.
Would this be the first cross-reference to 84? We already do that as a matter of course for other issues.
Mr. Chairman, there are a number of other issues. In fact, I was just looking it up now. I did look at this earlier, and there are other areas where the Data Practices Act just cross-references the statute where the data practices are being either restrained or opened or whatever is being done. But it is elsewhere, and so what you're either in the Data Practices Act where all the restrictions or conditions are put in place, or there's a cross-reference somewhere else, and they've tried to do as much of that as they can, that cross-referencing.
Okay. So the Data Privacy Act is this general statute, and then for each discipline, so to speak, they oftentimes cross-reference to that relevant chapter.
Mr. Chairman, yes. In fact,
that might be the case for transportation or education or other things.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay. All right. Okay. Okay. So we're opening up the information collected to these various purposes on the second page. So the committee needs to decide if we want to do that in law. Senator Dibble?
Thank you. Getting to that very question. Mr. Meyer, on 2.6, paragraph 3, can you tell us what use, what normal course of business by legitimate business or its agents, employees, or contractors to verify accuracy of personal information is?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, that's a great question. But before I do that, I want to make sure people understand. Currently, there are 14 permissible uses that our data is open and available to right now. We pick up 9 of those, basically, with this change and put it into Chapter 84. But I'm going to have Ms. Deo talk about your request, and if the committee so desires, we can talk about the 14 permissible uses right now.
That's helpful. Thank you for clarifying.
Mr. Chair, members, the 14 permissible uses are what were developed under the federal law to allow the release of driver's license information regarding motor vehicles. When we combined our system with DPS, our data became restricted, and we needed to follow those 14 permissible uses in the release. So these nine here are the exact language that comes from the federal law, and we found that we did need to release data for the same reasons motor vehicle data needed to be released for ATVs and watercraft, basically, and the motorcycles that we register. So it's more directed towards the recreational vehicle data. I can give specific examples.
That might help with the context.
Mr. Chair, members, it would be under the, if you look at, she was trying to find her information, banks looking to repossess a snowmobile or a watercraft that they have a lien on, trying to verify the address that it would be under. It would be someone, if you would purchase a snowmobile or something at a garage sale, for example, and you wanted to make sure you got the title for that machine. Ms. Dale does have her paper now, so she can talk about more examples.
Mr. Chair, members, for example, insurance companies are looking for information on whether or not a person owns, say, a watercraft for workman's compensation claim investigations, accident claims, insurance and anti-fraud investigations, proof of ownership for collection purposes. We also have financial institutions for collection purposes. We have towing companies that contact us if they've towed a boat or recreational vehicle and they're trying to determine who the owner is. As far as other government agencies, the IRS and Department of Revenue for collection purposes as well. For example, back taxes, they would confiscate someone's boat or their ATV. Other state governments contact us to verify ownership of transferred vehicle titles. And Department of Human Services is in contact with us regarding child support enforcement, whether or not an individual may or may not have a fishing or hunting license.
So we've not been able to enforce that portion of child support law to date? And that, therefore, we need this change?
Well, this is currently how it's released under the federal government, so we would like to be able, when they come to us for that, we would like to be able to release information for that purpose.
Okay. So why do we need this new language if there are already rules, federal rules?
Well, once our new database comes into place, it will no longer be restricted data under the federal law because it's not collected through DPS. It will become public data under the Minnesota Data Practices Act. And under public data, it will, you know, we would need to release it to anyone that asks for it.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Meyer.
Staff has a copy, and I apologize, I didn't bring copies of this for the committee, but maybe we could pass that around. Of the current form that a person would have to, person or a business would have to fill out, and the 14 permissible uses that are attached to that are currently under practice. So what we're trying to do here is protect the status quo for after when the system comes on March 1st of 2010, if the legislature so desires.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
Just to also further clarify the policy issue for the committee, those 14 permissible uses that are in federal law are not something that where the federal law is kind of preempting what the state wants to do in this situation. In other words, we could decide to offer more protection to individuals and more protection of their private information if we chose to do that. So, so that again is a policy choice.
Ms. Deo, under the 14 list, which ones are not included in your list of nine here?
Steve, do you have?
That may be our only copy, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Another thing, Mr. Chair, I would point out is that right now, someone would not be able to get aggregate information under existing law, under the DPS, of a list of the names of, say, they wanted everyone in the state who got a fishing license last year or something. Under this change, we're not including the name as protected information. We're including address, driver's license number, and date of birth as being protected except in these exception situations. We could decide to make that if we included name in that list, then we would be mirroring the way the situation is handled today.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe Mr. Meyer or Ms. Dale. Several years ago, when we got our license, we were also requested or required to submit our Social Security number. Is that still held in a database and being used for something? Or,
Mr. Chair, members, that's a requirement under federal Health and Human Services provision for child. Child payments, making sure that people are current on their support payments. But I don't believe that information is not within that database. It wouldn't be released at all. I mean, that's private data now.
Under the nine that you have here, which exceptions could release information in bulk? Are most of these, except for the research, just individuals?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct.
Can a insurer request make a bulk request of names in connection with a claims investigation?
Mr. Chair, members, under the way this is currently written, names would be public data. So if someone did make that request under the Data Practices Act, we would need to release all the names.
Under this new law, or a new law you're proposing, would the insurer be able to acquire the information in bulk as using the claims investigation activity exception?
If they were requesting the names, the addresses, date of birth would not be released. Those would be classified as private.
Mr. Chair,
okay.
If
Senator
I
Olson?
Could clarify,
mm-hmm.
They wouldn't have to use that exception because anybody could request names in bulk the way this is written. If we want to change that, then on line 1.19, after 12 and the colon, we could insert name, comma, and then with the rest of the information there, it would be private except for those purposes where you have to have a specific reason to ask for the information, and then you wouldn't have any bulk releasing. Then you would just have releasing of information as needed on an individual basis.
Name, address, driver's license number, and date of birth are the only things that can be released under these exceptions. Ms. Dale?
Yes, that's correct.
Under what situations do we need to release the driver's license number? Senator Olson?
Actually, Mr. Chair, I was going to make an oral amendment because we really don't need to release the driver's license information in the Department of Corrections has asked that we make that change to this bill. Our Department of Public Safety has asked that we make that change. So the oral amendment I would like to offer on line 1.23 after the subparen, I would insert comma, other than a driver's license number, comma.
Why don't we just delete driver's license number on 19?
Because, Mr. Chair, that is part of the information that's collected, and so we need to have it categorized as private since it is collected. But then what we would be saying by that amendment is that when we did release information because it was subject to one of those exceptions, we would not release the driver's license information.
Right. So then under the exceptions, it would only be a person's name, address, and date of birth.
That's correct.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And what do we need the address as well, home address as well? Is that important?
Mr. Chair, for some of the intended purposes of the information would be verifying addresses, or in the case of somebody who was looking to reclaim property, in the case of a repossession or something like that, you would want to verify the address. So the address is vital for some people who need access to this data.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Is the same with the date of birth? You have to have date of birth?
Mr. Chair, I believe that within our database, you would find maybe 10 or 15 John Olsons. So to help with the identification piece, the address and the date of birth, mm-hmm. help with that.
Yeah. I'm asking these things just because of some of the past work on identity theft. You get someone's driver's license number. That's pretty much all you need. But then if you have a date of birth and home address, then that person is really up the creek. Big identity theft cases, security breaches have occurred, where a dummy company is created and they request under purposes of research the information. And so then now you've got driver's license numbers for lots of people. You start producing checks, fake checks, and you're off to the races. So that's kind of one of my main curiosities here, and how we can try to accomplish what you want to do, but not create more problems. Senator Olson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And honestly, again, this is a policy decision for this committee and the Data Practices Committee to evaluate, but I think those are very legitimate concerns, and some of the concerns that I've shared in discussing this with the department. Frankly, I would have no problem with erring more on the side of making this information more private to avoid those kinds of identity thefts you talked about, as opposed to making it easier for someone to find, how they can repossess a vehicle or whatever, because I think there are other ways to find that information. And I also just have a kind of a, because it's so, these exceptions are so broadly written, there are certainly legitimate purposes where people may want to use it for legitimate business purposes, but there are also easy ways for people for non-legitimate purposes to make use of this to get this information. So I don't know. To me, if I'm going to go fishing and I'm required by the state to get a license for a non-governmental use of this, I would rather have to give my permission before this information could be released. But the department has not been doing that up to this point, and that would be a change of policy in a different direction in terms of making the information more private.
Yeah, because what happened with that the choice point thing and problem in California, that case, the information wasn't stolen. It was just a fake company that bought the information for purportedly legitimate purposes under whatever guidelines they had, and then it just went sour from there. Now I think we should err on the side of caution too. I just want to make sure that I don't want to muck up the legitimate purposes either, and that's what we've always struggled with data privacy and identity theft issues. If we were to, and I'm not suggesting this, but if we were just to, what would happen if we were to
delete everything after line 22 on page 1.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Then there would be no exceptions. And I would suggest that we at least need to have on the following page number 1 and number 2, because number 1 is allowing within government law enforcement purposes to get this information, and I think that's legitimate and important, and it's not going outside to anyone that isn't subject to the Data Practices Act. And number 2, I think we really want people to get, like, recalls and that type of thing, although certainly that potentially could be misused. But for sure, I think we need number 1.
No.
And I do have an amendment that might make it easier to deal with if that's the direction this committee wants to go. I have an amendment that takes out a lot of those other things. Basically, it would just, the amendment would keep everything private for, it would allow the Department of Natural Resources to use the information for recruitment, retention, and training certification and verification, and then for any of these other purposes, if I inserted to this amendment with the consent of the licensee, then it could be released for other purposes. So at least you'd give the person a choice if they want to be able to make their information more public. So that would be an option. With this is the A1 amendment.
Senator, the A1 still has listed financial institutions, legal process servicers, service servers, insurance and towing companies.
Private investors.
And Mr. Chair, what I'm suggesting is that on line 1.20 after the and, the second and, that you would insert with the consent of the licensee, and so that none of those other purposes would be releasable unless you had the specific consent of the licensee to release it.
Well, then you might as well just delete them all.
Well, that's, I suppose in a sense that's true, because you do have always the ability to obtain the information with the consent of the licensee. So I suppose you could just delete the rest of that. But I think
so. Back to the original question. If we were to delete everything after line 22 on page 1 of the bill, you would not be able to do the government agency, court or law enforcement agency. And then on that number 1, any private person or entity acting on behalf of a federal, state, or local agency, what does that refer to?
Mr. Chair, lines 2.2 you're talking about there?
Correct.
Let Ms. Dale answer that question.
Ms. Dale.
Mr. Chair, that language comes directly from the federal language, and we've been operating under this federal language for the last 3 years, so we felt it was probably safe just to carry over the same language.
Okay.
I don't believe that we've ever had that experience or released it for that purpose.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Frederick.
Could I ask another question? On the bill, under Clause 4, excuse me, information as a result of a court order. excuse me. Wouldn't we have to always allow the release of the information pursuant to a court order? You know, if we don't have that in the state law, are we setting up a battle between the courts and state law?
Ms. Dale or Senator Olson?
Mr. Chair, I can't put my finger or point you to the statute off the top of my head, but I'm thinking that under the Data Practices Act, there's an exception anyway for information where there's a court order, and that that would fall under that exception to the overall classification under the Data Practices Act.
Ms. Dale, explain to me, it seems, I'm sensing that there's a timing issue. Something's going to expire soon and data will be released?
When is that going to happen? When will that date occur if we do not act?
Mr. Chair, members, we believe our new system will be up and running March of 2010. So a year from now, our new system will come into place.
Right.
At that time, the data will all become public data.
Okay. All right. At the very least, then, you would probably need up to line 3 of page 2.
So we don't need that in here. I'm sure the fence just included.
Is that I'm asking, Ms. Day or Mr. Meyer? Absolute bare minimum to protect the information and allow, you know, smooth functions of our government processes.
Mr. Chair, as Ms. Dale cited previously, these are all issues that are the data is currently public for right now. If a person files that request, these are all permissible uses for driver's license data currently. We're just trying to keep the system at par with what it is right now and what a person or an entity for legal purposes, mostly a lot of these are for insurance purposes, operator safety and theft, emissions, product alterations, recalls. If Polaris, for example, had a recall on all of their 2004 700 ATVs, Sportsman Polaris 700s, and they'd want to verify the information they have through our registration system, and we didn't have this language here, they wouldn't be able to get that they wouldn't be able to get that data if number 2 wasn't there, for example. So it's the committee's desires. It's up to the committee always, but we just wanted to bring a bill forward that allows basically practicing capturing status quo and protecting those purposes going into the future.
Let me ask you this: whether these exceptions are in there or not, doesn't the Federal Driver's Privacy Protection Act apply anyway as superseding law?
Mr. Chair, it will no longer apply to our data since our data will no longer be hooked up with Department of Public Safety Motor Vehicle. The individual will be handing us their information. It will be classified according to how our agency handles our information, and within the DNR it would be, and under data practices it would be classified as public. So these restrictions would no longer apply.
Under the Driver's Privacy Protection Act, what about any of the other privacy acts? Trying to think, I don't remember the acronyms as well as I did when I was working on this stuff. There's a whole bunch of federal privacy information acts. This deals with driver's licenses. There's other that deals with medical records, HIPAA,
right.
And there's some others.
The only one that I know that applies to our data would be the federal law and Social Security numbers,
okay.
which would be private.
And since this is driver's license number, then you're dealing with driver's license numbers here, then the Driver's Privacy Protection Act applies. It did apply until you changed it over.
Right.
And why doesn't it apply again?
Because we're no longer collecting data through the Department of Public Safety. And that federal law is where that data is classified for Department of Public Safety. So when we sever our ties with them and an individual gives us their license number, it's them giving us the data, and it would be classified however a department would classify it under Chapter 13. So, for instance, the Department of Human Services has their own laws about what is private and what is not. And so when an individual gives them their driver's license number for whatever reason, it would be classified according to Department of Human Services restrictions.
Does it matter? So are you saying that it matters in the federal law where the driver's license information came from?
Mr. Chair, not in the federal law, but within the state law. So
why don't we just change that?
Mr. Chair, I think DPS tried that last year.
Whether it comes from DPS or an ELS station, it's still a driver's license number.
Mr. Chair, thank you. If some of these groups or agencies want this information after March of 2010, they can just go to the Department of Public Safety and request it.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct, but the Department of Public Safety won't have information on a watercraft or ATV. They'll have information on a car. And under this language with the verbal amendment, the driver's license number will always be private. It will not be released under these exceptions. It would only be the name, the address, and the date of birth.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think you hit the home run by just taking paragraphs 1 and 2.
Yeah, I mean, I accept that these are already rules, and you're mirroring some of the rules, and so you're scaling back on some, which are good. Maybe you could pass this up, and you could tell us which ones are not being included, and then. I'm just wondering, because you remember at the onset of the bill, I said, well, we're opening up this information to this group of people, and that was wrong. I was wrong. It's already open, but because we're making this affirmative act of writing things out in state law, I'm just wondering if that act itself is going to promote these activities, whereas before, someone really had to know the federal law and really be in these activities as opposed to inviting the fact that one can access this information freely. Senator Kielash, did you have your number?
Yes.
Your hand up?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, if I've the conversation's kind of got me confused a little bit, but my understanding is this bill as currently written is going to do everything the current federal law does as far as protecting people that offer the DNR their license or the Department of National Resources their license. Am I right there?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Except that under the current system, if we want to completely mirror the current system on line 1.19, we'd have to include the name, or the word name, so that there can't be an aggregate request for aggregate names of everyone who's gotten a license for whatever the thing might be. But other than that, I think, Senator Kielash, you are correct that what we're doing right now in terms of how we're treating this information is based on these exceptions in federal law. And that's what's being mirrored in this bill.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair? Senator Olson, one of the other things is the current system really protecting citizens that are applying for licenses? And if it is there any reason to go further with it?
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash. Actually, in judiciary, we've spent a lot of time on this subject. Because the world has really changed in the last just few years with data harvesters and identity thievers and people who are always trying to get little pieces of information about a person so they can put it together and then use that information to, say, apply for a credit card in that person's name. And so it's a real problem. There are also harvesters out there who are going and getting information and then reselling it for purposes that the person who just, you know, got a fishing license or whatever probably didn't intend or wouldn't want. And so the world is really evolving in this area, and we're trying to keep up with it in judiciary and on the data practices and on the Financial Crimes Task Force and some other legislation Senator Chaudhry has, you know, carried in the past or been involved with. So it is a concern. I think the federal government some years ago passed federal law to try to put some kind of limitations around this, but I think that technology has evolved quite a bit past where it was when those laws were passed even? So I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that brings to mind then, do we need to go further than this, in your opinion, or is this going to be suffice to allow the data practices, Department of Natural Resources to change to the new computer system and still keep that information private?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, I guess I would tend to agree more with the comments that we've heard from the chair and from Senator Scogin in terms of being more limiting of this information even than what the DNR is proposing here. I would add name to the number so that we can't have an aggregate requirement for names. I think no one really needs the driver's license information through this system, so I'd insert that even ahead of those subdivisions 1 and 2. And then the only other one I would say that makes there's no reason not to include it would be number 9, which is basically just allowing somebody with the written consent of the subject. They should certainly be able to authorize someone to get that information, you know, if they're applying for a mortgage or if they're doing something. But then it has to be on their authorization. And so that way, any of these purposes where someone would want someone to have it, they could get an authorization from the person.
Where was that name insertion?
Mr. Chair, on line 1.19, mm-hmm. after the colon.
Okay, name. All right. Okay. So, unless someone has an objection, we could do an amendment that on 1.19 inserts. After the colon, inserts name, comma. On 1.23, after the para, other than the driver's license number, comma. And then deletes parts 2 through 8. And then if we do that, then this has got to go to judiciary anyway. And then we can see what the pushback is on returning those items and go from there. Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I support that amendment. I had a couple of questions, though, of some of the items that remain, even after that amendment might
okay.
be adopted.
Okay.
Do you want me to ask those now?
Let's explore this concept and dispose of it one way or another first. Senator Olson?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would consider that a friendly amendment, and I would also suggest that I'd be happy to continue to work with the department if there are specific concerns that this raises for them. And maybe as to those concerns, we could craft some language that would be a little more narrow to get at those specific concerns as opposed to the way that it's, you know, these aren't the department's suggestions, as you know, they come from federal law, but perhaps we could still try to deal with some concerns they might have with our own language.
All right. I'd move that amendment, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
All right. Senator Olson, Phoebe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify your amendment. Did you say on page 2, delete 2 through 8?
Yes.
So we would leave 9?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
So Senator Scogin will move that. Senator Dibble on the amendment?
No.
Discussion? Everyone understand what we're doing there? Council? You got it? All right. Got the other than driver's license and the name. Okay.
Good name.
Discussion, Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I thought 9 was the weakest one that you were interested in deleting. Maybe I misunderstood.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, that's one that I would say would be one that would be appropriate to leave in because it requires an authorization from the person, the
Okay.
You know, so it's not going to go without their permission, but there might be a reason why they want to be able to show in getting a mortgage or in saying a request for getting warranty information or whatever. As long as that person's authorized it, I certainly don't have a problem with releasing it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, it seems like deleting, or maybe Mr. Meyer, it seems like deleting all of this leaves the folks that are interested in doing a legitimate business or have concerns like liens and all of that stuff without any access to the data that they would need to reclaim their property in some cases or some of the other legitimate purposes for supplying this information. I'm not sure that the goal is to cut out all of those legitimate reasons, access to this database at all, because it seems to me that it eliminates that access to the database.
And, you know, my feeling on it, Senator Kielash, is having done some of this stuff, let the Data Privacy Committee sort it out. The stakeholders of these monitor that. They'll be on it. And if it's a big deal, they'll approach the committee and Senator Olson for reinsertion. And at least there will be some record where they can state why it needs to be, at the very least. And then if you're doing that in the Data Privacy Committee, in the past I recall inserting at times encryption language, and you can explore that too, whether that be appropriate or not, whether that, when you give the information, should be encrypted. Is there any intent, Mr. Meyer, in this bill to allow the information to be used for political purposes?
Good question. Mr. Chair, no. Previously, before 2006, when this information was all public, it was a highly coveted source of information, the deer hunters list, the fishing list. This is exactly the reason why we have this issue before you, to have your decision and may have the legislature help us in making a determination on what the future, how this data should be handled into the future. So that is completely up to the will of the legislature, Mr. Chair.
So in addition to kind of identity theft issue of our stakeholders in this committee, one thing that we need to be consider in these exceptions is, can my private investigator friend get a hold of the DNR list and slip it to me? And if I send a mailing out to those people, there's pretty much no way they can find out how I got the list. So that's something we need to consider. And that's why I think it might be a good idea for us to back way off and then let people who are truly interested in the information and have a legitimate reason come forward, talk about it, and let's make sure that we craft it tightly.
Mr. Chair, all of those cases, actually, the person will be asking for a specific record. We do not intend under any of these sections to provide bulk lists for any means. You can see on that specifically 2.28, for any licensed private investigative agency or service person for any purpose permitted under this section, they would have to provide, we would update that form, and on the back side of the form would be the allowable purposes. They would have to fill that out, our data practices, people would review it, and we would provide them only the limited data that they would be requesting.
But when we were trying to limit data access to individual records, the argument against it was that, well, we do lots of claims, say it's insurance. We do lots of claims, and we submit, you know, every quarter we submit a list, and so to the relevant place, and then we get a bulk list. And it might be 50, it might be 1,000, or it might be all of them, or close to all of them. So those are the types of discussions we've had and gone back and forth on, and that's why I just kind of I wonder out loud about these particular provisions. Not that they have any ill intent. Senator Olson?
And Mr. Chair, I just I also like to do what I think is honoring what a person's expectations would be in terms of privacy. I mean, I think when people provide identifying information to a government agency, that their expectation is that the government agency is going to respect that information and not make it available to someone else without their permission, except with unless there's a really good reason for doing that, that we would have to be able to justify to the public why we gave that information. Because it isn't like they have a choice if they want to fish or they want to own a boat or they whatever. We're requiring them to get these licenses, and I just think we should honor the privacy of that information whenever possible.
On the Scogan Amendment, everyone understand it? Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Dibble, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple things. First, I'd like to, I'd just like to move another amendment, another deletion. Maybe we just put period out on line 2.2 after functions. And just delete the private person or entity acting on behalf of a federal, state, or local agency and carrying out its functions. I think that, Mr. Chair, is already implied. State agencies carrying out its functions if they're working with some private entity, but oh no, just something sends up a flag. Maybe we should, if they want to argue to get that back in, we can have them do that in judiciary as well.
Mr. Knopf also informs me that in that same part, including a court, apparently courts are not subject to the Data Privacy Act, and that word would be redundant. Would you like to just kind of include that in your amendment, too?
Sure.
All right. So Senator Dibble moves that on page 2, line 1, delete court or, and then after on line 2.2, delete everything after functions and insert a period after functions, mm-hmm. and then delete line 2.3. Is that correct, Senator Dibble?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Discussion? Seeing none, all those. Senator Olson, did you have?
Mr. Chair, I just think you'd insert a semicolon since you also have another one down below.
All right, the amendment is on line 2.3, delete the entire line. Instead of a period after functions, it would be a semicolon. All right, discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Further discussion on Senate file 1341. Senator Dibble?
Thanks. I just had a question for Mr. Meyer. What is the natural resources management purposes of recruitment, retention, training, certification, and verification?
Mr. Meyer.
Chair, members, that's going to be firearm safety numbers. We'd be perhaps contacting people why that in the past what we've done is we've contacted people who haven't bought a fishing license for the past couple of years and sent them a survey. Why haven't you gone fishing? Mm-hmm. How was your fishing season? Things like that. Recruitment training would be advertising or providing information about upcoming training activities that may be out there. Verification of the data that we have, making sure that the information we have in our system is correct. Other business functions, we have educational programs, things like that. School, forest, Minocqua, things of that nature. Research data, we'd still be able to do. One of the concerns I had, and we'll review all of these things that we've taken out, was that now we're prohibited somebody for use in research activities and producing statistical reports, providing that the personal information is not published, redisclosed, or used. But we'll work through the author and data privacy subcommittees on all those issues, but we would still be able to do our research activities with that.
They sent out a survey to anglers. Mm-hmm. A random sampling, mm-hmm. past anglers. Is the new data system, Ms. Dale, going to include an option for
including one's email address.
Mr. Chair, members, not that I'm aware of at this time.
Can we make sure that that happens?
Yes.
I'd appreciate it. This goes back to the question I had kind of earlier this session when I went hunting in South Dakota last year. In January, I received an email encouraging me to renew. New spring licenses are for sale. Please buy. Here's the link to our site. Seemed like it'd be a common sense thing to do. And we don't have to require it. Just put it on as a and your technical people can figure out, but just as an option, if someone wants to apply it for contact with the DNR, the email.
Mr. Chair, would you also like that then to be private data, the email address?
Yeah, definitely.
Then we would need to.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to point that out, that you raised a very good point when you brought that up, and I'm not sure why we just want to list home address as something that we're going to make private. Someone might give a business address or an email address, as you pointed out. So I would suggest you might want to just delete home and then include and say addresses, you know, maybe with the S and
N. Okay, then that could include potentially email addresses.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
So move.
Okay, Senator Scogin moves on line 1.19, delete home address and insert addresses. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Further discussion?
Do you want to put an effective date on that?
Do we need an effective date on this, Dale?
I believe there should be one, Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was thinking March 1st, 2010, if this is when the new system's going into place, then it wouldn't. Otherwise, it's going to conflict with the federal law that they're under right now.
Senator Olson?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Meyer agrees with that.
All right. So Senator Scogin will move page 2 after line 31, insert effective date March 1st, 2010. March 1st, 2010.
And Mr. Chairman, you'd put that after each section.
Okay. So moved. Everyone understand that? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion? See, this, we spent 50 minutes on this. This is what the data privacy people do every day.
Mr. Chair, I was going to say thanks for all your help getting my bill cleaned up before I take it there.
So, no, this is it's important for us to know this, because we get our constituents are all going to ask us what's going on. So we need to know. Senator Dibble?
Move the bill.
Okay. Senator Dibble moves that Senate file 1341 as amended. You recommended to pass, re-refer to
your
the Committee on Judiciary. Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much,
Senator
Mr. Olson. Chair, committee members.
All right, Senator Poby.
Who's next?
Thank you. Come on, take this for a minute.
Members, we move to Senate File 1449, Senator Phoebe's bill. Good evening, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. My name is Lisa Phoebe, Senator Lisa Phoebe, and I'm here on behalf of Senate File 1449, and this is a different topic, another cleanup bill. It's a bill dealing with septic systems, which are very important for us in many parts of the state. And basically, before I get started, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Senator Phoebe moves the A1. It's coming around the table, I believe.
Yeah.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Maybe this is the A090180 amendment. Is that what you're getting right now?
It says
A1?
Senator Phoebe, I have the A1.
Okay. Maybe I have something different. This has gone through a few changes in the last 24 hours. Thank you. There we go.
The amendment's been handed out, Senator Phoebe, so the bill is yours.
Okay.
Senator Phoebe moves the A1. Questions? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Senator Phoebe.
This bill before you, it is an agency bill, and I've worked with them on it with a few different things. And this, basically, it's got a lot of several minor technical changes. Updating language and removing obsolete references in the statute. So without any further ado, I am going to turn this over to Gretchen. Sorry, and she's not on your sheet. I apologize for that.
Is it Sable?
It is.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Sable,
on your
it's all right. Just trying to move. It's late for everyone, Senator.
It's late. After about 6 o'clock, I kind of turn into a pumpkin, so I apologize. So, yes, I'm going to turn it over to Gretchen for the details.
Ms. Sable, welcome to the committee for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Gretchen Sable. I'm with the Pollution Control Agency, and I work in the septic system program, and it's nice to be back. The statute was written in 1994 by some of the people here in this room yet and amended every year since. And what has happened over the years is there's been things put in that were bridges to get to over problem areas. There were temporary fixes here and there. There were things that are now obsolete for those reasons. There's inconsistent wording here and there. So it's kind of a cleanup to try to address that. Did they get a copy of our fact sheet?
Yes.
Okay.
It's coming, Ms. Sable, I believe it's coming around or will be shortly.
Because of the way the statute is, I think that I'll just give you a summary based on the fact sheet because it lumps things a little more. And then if you want to talk about the specific details in the bill, we can talk about that. I will tell you as you get the paper here, I guess that's happened now, but we did work with the statutory established advisory committee. We worked with them on this language, so some of the changes you see come from them. We've worked with the Minnesota On-Site Wastewater people and also the Minnesota Association of Realtors, and so their issues have been addressed within this bill. So I'm looking at the fact sheet. If you open that up, you see that we have, first, we do change the words. The statute was initially written saying individual sewage treatment system, and then within the definition in the statute, it included a group thereof. In the years since 94, there's been more and more cluster systems built at resorts, housing developments, even small communities now are using this technology. And so to encompass those, we've changed the word in our rules from individual to subsurface, and we'd like to do that in the statute as well. So that's the first change. And we also, we license businesses and not individuals, and so we wanted to also change that. So that's kind of an overall change, and change the word licensed then to also certify. We certify the individuals, and we license the businesses. So those are the three big changes that happened throughout. When you look at some of the policy issues, there's a few smaller issues. First would be around disclosure. When you sell a home, you're required to tell the buyer what you know of the quality of that system, and that's been in statute for quite a while. What we would do with this, and this was a change that was negotiated with the Realtors Association, is to say that if you've had an inspection done, that you have to provide that inspection. So that gives a little bit more certainty to the buyer. Not a big deal, but it's a little bit of an incremental change. Another area that there's been a larger issue is that the pipe that comes from the house to the septic tank is actually part of the building, part of the plumbing. It's regulated under plumbing code. And the people that connect to that pipe or that work on that pipe needed to get also a plumbing bond and certification. So that was kind of a dual bonding. The plumbing bond is $25,000. The septic bond is $10,000. What this language would do would be allow us to work with labor and industry to develop a single bond, $25,000, to address both. So they would save that cost. And we're making a similar change in our rule to do that. So that's I think that's a good change there. Otherwise, some of the less major things is just a consistency change to limit the subsurface sewage treatment systems regulated to here on, in this statute to those that don't require a PCA permit.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask?
Senator Anderson.
Excuse me, I'm sorry to interrupt, but can you refer to sections of the bill as you talk about
them? Sure.
That would be helpful to follow along.
I can just go through. I'm sorry, Senator.
Trying to keep track of what your which pieces you're talking about.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, I will do that.
Ms. Sable?
I tried it. The bill is kind of large and complex, so it was difficult to talk consistently that way, too.
Okay.
So I thought I'd try the other way. But going back then to the statute, if you look at the definition of, so if we're starting on page one, you'll see that we do individual to subsurface quite a bit. So a few wording changes for consistency. On page two of the bill, at line 2.4, we're adding some new terminology. We have a new classification for people that take care of advanced treatment systems called service provider. And then we change pumper names to maintainers. So that's a change there. 2.7 to, so we need to do rules for this, and we're adding to that the closure of septic systems. The rules are already completed. This is to clarify that that's something that was also included there. At 2.20, another pumper to maintainer. I think that most of these are not anything too earth-shattering. Down at 2.31, this is something that this committee had worked on a couple years ago, the straight pipe law. It was a Senator Jungbauer law. We have found in enforcement of this law that when we say includes toilet waste, that limited our enforcement when we had situations where they had washing laundry water and things like that going out that still contains a lot of phosphorus. It's an issue for surface waters, and so we want to take the toilet waste out so we can. This has actually proven to be a pretty good enforcement tool. We've had 140-some cases brought to us by local governments under this law, and of those, all but I think five have resolved. As soon as they get the letter from the state that says you're going to be subject to $500 per day, when you read this later in the statute, they fix those things. So, going on. Page three, we do the individual subsurface. There's no other changes in the local ordinance part. In the rules, at 3.26, that's just old language again, taking that piece out. Oh, here's a piece that somebody asked about, 3.34. The word seasonal saturation was the old term that we called redoxamorphic features in the soil. We now call them periodic because they can occur for other reasons besides seasonal change. So that's a change in terminology. At line 4.3 then on page 4, the rules are already in place. So it's just a date that's been met, and we don't need that line in the statute any longer. In the inspection parts, which so now I've skipped down to section 5, starts at 4.12. What we're doing here, there was a piece in this that said that you can do your inspection by video, electronic, photographic. That's not consistent with how plumbing inspections, electrical inspections, other inspections are done. And we actually require them to physically go on site and examine the soil during their inspection. And so taking that out would get better results on inspections. So in Part B, the statute had required that a person that wants to add a bedroom had to bring their system into compliance before that could happen. We want to shift that to that an inspection has to happen. And what that does is it means that the homeowner would have the inspection, and then if they're in compliance, they're good. If they're not in compliance, they would have either 10 months if it's an imminent threat or the length of time the local government allows, which is how the statute works, for the upgrade otherwise. And we've found that local governments have been wise in doing that. They know the quality of systems in their area, and they set that carefully. So I think that's a good way to kind of respect the work that the local governments do and give the homeowner more flexibility because they don't have to do it immediately.
Ms. Sable?
Yes, sir.
If they choose then not to do, if they're not in compliance and they then choose not to do the construction because they've been found out of compliance, are they required to upgrade?
Yes, they are, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Once the inspection happens, the inspection triggers an inspection report that goes to the local unit of government. If it's a notice of noncompliance, they have to upgrade the system within 10 months if it's surfacing or discharging to surface water, and a different time period set by local government if it's not. So, going over to page 5, oh, 6, I'm sorry. No, sorry, page 5, section 6. What we're doing there with that inspection criteria for existing system is just rearranging the order that the statute appears in, because it had a definition that limited existing system on page 6, and we moved it forward so it was to make it easier to read. Section 7, starting at line 6.2, we're going to say it needs to be a certified inspector. We don't have site evaluators, and designers don't do that work, so certified inspectors. And then the paragraph B, this was a provision that was one of those bridge provisions when we started the program. Now, because of the changes we made about the inspection, so that they have to get the inspection and not the compliance, I think that takes care of that, so we don't need to do that any longer, and that's stricken. Section 6 was where I was talking about disclosure. This is the part that we negotiated with the Minnesota Association of Realtors. You can see there's some wording changes to make it read better because there has been a lot of confusion about it. And then the at line 7.18 is where the previous inspection reports, 7.19, a previous inspection report must be provided, attached to the disclosure statement. Coming down then to 7.32, this is warranted systems. This is another part of the bill that was put in to provide a bridge so that manufacturers could bring their products in for sale in Minnesota before we had a process and rule for doing that. We now have a process and rule, and it will be effective February 4th, 2010. We're working with manufacturers now on this registration process, and so we wanted to sunset this provision whenever that becomes effective. Going then into on page line 9.2, we're beginning revisions to the licensing statute 1.15.56. So now we begin to see not just the individual subsurface, but the lingo of certified individuals, licensed businesses appearing. We have the change that we're going to that the rules the license applies to systems that don't require a state permit. Going down on line 9.27, this is something that was amended with the amendment. So you're going to want to look at the amendment at line 1.7. What that says is that, so this is the piece that says, when you read the statute, a license is required to install a septic system. B is the exceptions. There's an exception for an individual who constructs a system that's owned or leased by that individual and functions solely as their own system. So that's like working on your own plumbing. We wanted to add, unless specifically disallowed in local ordinance, and then modify that to say that the homeowner must follow the local requirements if they're going to do the work. So instead of being specific about being covered in a compliance report, it would say that they must comply with all local administrative and technical requirements, which would include covering and that kind of thing. So it's similar in nature, and the rest of that language moved forward from later in the statute. For some reason, the statute was drafted with the piece that modified this provision following later. So we moved that up. Going then to the 10.8, well, that was the part that moved up. 10.16, you see we're 10.17, I'm sorry, is where we do the joint bond. And so that's the language that we had initially drafted this and sent it to the governor's office. The Department of Labor and Industry wanted that changed. And so when you look at the amendment, that's the amendment at 1.10 and also 1.16. So those are amendments to the bill that would bring the labor and industry's preferred language in here. The first change modifies 1.15.56, the statute that we work under. The second change modifies their statute, which is 326B.46. Oh. We do strike, an enforcement then. Enforcement is the wrap-up of this section 12 at line 11.15. We've had some actions with licensees where they have failed to resolve the action. They might have had a noncompliance. They might have an unpaid APO penalty. And our attorneys have told us without language like this, it isn't necessarily clear that we can withhold their license until they resolve that. So this gives us the authority to withhold their license until they have resolved their problem. The other thing that we should look at in the amendment is two places where there's lines that were added at the request of the Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Association. So that would be at line 1.3 on the amendment. As you recall, last year there was a lot of discussion, last 2 years, we have someone here who will talk more to that, but there was a lot of discussion about where the line between engineers and SSTS licensees falls. There was some statutory language, but there was continuing discomfort, and we have added this to clarify that if you're installing a system using a prescriptive design that's been laid out by the agency, then you don't have to worry about the requirements of the engineering statute, and that's what 326.03 is. And so that appears at 1.3 in the amendment, and then parallel language appears at 1.13. So,
questions for Ms. Sable? Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is APO penalty?
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebretson, we have administrative penalty order authority, and so when there's noncompliance, we'll issue an administrative penalty order to get the noncompliance resolved.
Thank you.
Other questions for Ms. Sable? Senator Fobey, we'll move to Eric Larson.
She had another amendment too in the packet. I don't know if you want to move that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me, Mr. Larson. Senator Fobey, did you have another amendment in your packet?
No.
That you wanted to move?
Let's hand it out.
Okay, I believe when we get to actually discussing the bill, I want to run some things by the committee, or I'll have Senator Chaudhry sit back at the chair. But
okay.
I don't know, is that, I don't know whose amendment that is. I guess. I haven't looked at them.
It's two different.
Mr. Chairman, there was another 809-0181 amendment that was passed out in the packet from the revisor's office, and I wasn't sure if that was something that the agency was trying to have included in the bill.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, that's something possibly we might be addressing later.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll move to Mr. Larson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and thank you for allowing me to testify once again. My name is Eric Larson. I am here representing the Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Association, or MOWA. We are a nonprofit trade association dedicated to education and professionalism among septic professionals. And I must say that today it's a great pleasure to sit before you in support of the agency legislation. When we were here 2 years ago and last year, we had significant unsettled issues in the industry. 2 years ago, the legislature instructed the stakeholders to work it out, and that was largely unsuccessful. Last year, you provided us some legislative support, and that became the underpinnings of our solution. And the MPCA has generated a significant body of work this past year to provide additional framework for design of septic systems under 5,000 gallons per day. We have had differences of opinion, interpretation of rule, guidance, and policy arising at times, but the stakeholders have been able to work them out. There is just one recently raised issue that we're starting to discuss, and we expect to work it out as well, and it revolves around the role of the SSTS Advisory Committee, which is chartered under 115. I also want to add a note briefly about the University of Minnesota training program, because we made reference to that program quality a number of times in previous testimony. And this past year, I had occasion to attend septic conferences in multiple locations around the nation, and I'd like to inform you that the USE program continues to be held in very high regard. It is commonly cited as a program of excellence, and by providing the knowledge needed among septic professionals, it is also significantly responsible for the success of this past year. So thank you very much.
Questions for Mr. Larson? Thank you. Ron Jasperson, Peter Larson, I guess we'll Mr. Jasperson, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ron Jasperson. I'm representing MAWA tonight. First, I just want to thank you for the last 2 years worth of work. Our industry would be very different than what it is today if it hadn't been for your help over these last couple of years. As Ms. Sable mentioned, the exemption language from that's been amended to exempt the 115 license from 326 is probably the major issue that we've been dealing with the last couple of years, and we finally got that into statute. That's very helpful. We have a couple of unresolved issues that we feel will be worked out internally with the agency. As Mr. Larson said, the one issue involves the advisory committee. When we agreed to the amendment last year for the design guidances, we worked out a dispute resolution process with the agency. And that appears to be working quite well. And the advisory committee has tickled us about trying to apply that to other issues within the agency. We feel that can be done within the agency and the advisory committee, and we wouldn't need to do that statutory yet. If that's not successful, we may be back to see you, because I think it's a real good addition to our stuff. The other issue, again, revolves around the design guidance. We feel that we're making extremely good headway on this design guidance. We've come a long way. We've had some bumps in the road. The dispute resolution has worked. We have every reason to believe it will, but it's not finished. And it needs to be finished before our licenses take effect in 2010. So we believe it will be. We don't anticipate coming back. We just want to let you know where our progress is. We feel we're making good headway. So thank you for the help that you've been over the years.
Mr. Jasperson, is there a particular point in the process where the dispute seems to generally occur, or does it vary from site to site?
Generally, the dispute has been over the agency restricting licenses by category. That's the way I personally would view that. I think right now you're getting outside the perimeter that I can speak for MAWA, but personally I think that it's the when the industry tries to restrict an entire category of a license of work that we can do without consideration to the simplicity of the system or the qualification of the designers. That's where we really run into, we both run on our own quarters and come out swinging when that happens. And I think that the dispute resolution has really taken the edge off of that conflict. We didn't anticipate having to use dispute resolution this year because the design guidance was supposed to go from 0 to 5,000. So personally, I sense a reluctance yet to develop that guidance to the full extent that our designers are capable of doing. But I'm very optimistic, especially the last couple months, that we're going to get there.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Jasperson. Larson, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Peter Larson. I'm an attorney with law firm of Larkin, Hoffman, Daly, and Lindgren, and I am here representing a company called Infiltrator Systems, Inc. I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee tonight. I'm here on behalf of one company and also speaking for some other companies. I want to talk to you a little bit about some letters you have in your materials. The matter that I'm here to talk about is Minnesota Statutes 115.55 Subdivision 9, which is in your bill on page 8. And there's a provision on page 9.1 that would sunset that law as of February 4th, 2010. The company I represent and other companies who sent you letters strongly support keeping that law in place and would oppose any sort of sunset of that law. Just to give you a little background about what my company does, what a couple other companies do, then I can talk to you a little bit about the letters that are here and why we think this is important. I'll just talk a little bit about my little plastic example here. This is a scale model of something that goes in a septic system drain field. It's a substitute, if you're familiar with it, for the rock and the pipe that goes into a septic system or drain field. So if you were to dig the trench for a drain field, it would be 36 inches wide. And in a rock system, you'd put rock in, you'd put a perforated pipe, you'd put some more rock in, you'd put some geofabric, you'd put some soil on top. With this product and a couple others I'll describe, you dig that same trench, but you set this right in the trench and cover it up with dirt. It's called a proprietary distribution product if you want to have a generic description for it. There's about 17,000 infiltrator systems in the state of Minnesota that use this. Many of them are installed at a size that's smaller than a rock drain field, and that's what we're talking about today. In 1997, this company came to Minnesota. They were really the pioneer of this and continue to be the industry leader, and asked the legislature to create a system where they could warranty for 5 years these systems and be allowed to go to counties and ask the counties to approve reduced size installations in their county. So what the company could do is they could go to a county, they could say, we would like you to approve up to a 40% reduction in size for drain fields in this county. We had to provide a warranty, we had to provide financial assurance to the state to support that warranty, and we had to supply a lot of technical information to the county to help them understand how the product worked. It's worked well. We've got 17,000 systems in place, again, some full-size, some not. We've got some statistics on failure rates. Out of those 17,000 systems, we have 23 reported malfunctioning systems. 8 of them were due to installer error. 5 of them were due to gopher damage to chambers. 4 of them were homeowner abuse, excessive flows. 3 to soil intrusion. 1 high groundwater table. 1 system doesn't match soil type. And 1 that's unknown. And something I want to point out is the reason we know that is when you put one of these in, it says infiltrator on it. And if you look closely, there's an 800 number. And if you have a problem with your system, Jeff Iverson comes in his truck, and he shows up at your site, and he works with the installer, and he fixes the problem. And while we're not here to say bad things about rock systems, we are here to say it's unlikely that the gravel pit owner is going to show up in a truck and help reinstall a system for you. So. Mr. Larson,
that would maybe beg the question, what's wrong with a rock system? What seems to fail, or why do you get a longer life out of a plastic pipe?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the life is really equal. I would say we don't claim a longer life. We claim equal performance. We have probably a stack this high of studies from the University of Colorado School of Mines, University of South Carolina, several different kinds of studies on longevity. The simplest way to describe it is the rock in a septic system creates a void in the soil to hold the septage. That's the function of the rock. This does the same thing. It creates a void in the soil to hold the septage. Our studies show, and most states agree, that because there isn't rock on the soil, because there's an open bottom, when you put this in a trench, that open bottom area is more efficient and allows for a smaller size system to have the same efficiency.
How many states allow this?
All states allow it at full size. I've provided you with a packet that's got a table that shows you the 48 states, 50 states actually, but it shows you the 48 states that allow some sort of reduction. 48 states allow some sort of reduction from the length of a rock chamber trench. That's the way it's described in this table. What I also did for you is I highlighted how long these approvals have been placed. If you can see this table I handed out, it's a green one. And I highlighted not only the states other than two, which are Massachusetts and Alaska, that don't allow reductions, but I also highlighted the approvals that are more than 20 years old. So if you go down here, you see that an Alaska approval, while it's 0%, there's lots of issues up there and very little incentive to go state change the law. But if you go down farther, you see Connecticut, a 1987 approval, Georgia, 1987, Idaho, 1989, Kentucky, 88. You can see the rest of them. But the reason, Mr. Chair, that I wanted to provide this in this manner is I wanted to show both the reductions and the number of years that those reductions have been in place. The really pioneering state is Maine. If you look at Maine, the reduction is 50% from the size of a rock drain field, and that approval was put in place, I guess I didn't highlight that one, in 1986. We were actually a copycat of a concrete chamber in that state, and Maine has had that 50% reduction since 1974. So it's that about 35 years that reduction's been in place.
And just for the committee's information, these are manufactured in this state?
These are manufactured in several different states. They're not manufactured here. That kind of, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, I can use that as a
sure.
reason to go to the letters that I have here, and I can use that as a way to describe to you. My client is Infiltrator Systems, one of the biggest plastic recycling companies in the country as well, because these are made of mostly recycled plastic. About 50% of the septic systems in the country have something like this or a knockoff of it. Our company makes their product, I believe, in Utah and Kentucky. I'm sure plastic goes from here to there. The second letter supporting maintaining the law is from a distribution company in Minnesota. They don't manufacture anything here. ADS, one of the largest plastic pipe manufacturers in the country. They make something that was a copycat of our product. They have a manufacturing facility here for plastic pipe, but not this. And then finally, ADS, or Easy Flow on the back, they make a different kind of product, and they're manufactured, I believe, in Tennessee.
I understand up in the area that I live in, where these reduced systems come in handy when we get on some small lots and some rocky ground and the like, marginal farmland sometimes. Is that typically where these 17,000 units have been put in?
Mr. Chair, that is true. There are many in that sort of situation. The 17,000 include everything from 40% reduced to full size. The counties that approve them will allow them on smaller lots or bigger lots. Larson, the other Mr. Larson that was up here earlier, is the type of designer that we work for. I'd just like to use him, Mr. Chair, as an example. He's the one that decides for you whether you're going to have smaller, bigger septic system components like this, rock. And so our company works with Mr. Larson, folks like him, and they're the ones that decide, working with your county officials, with their design, what's good for your county or your lot.
Questions for Mr. Larson? Senator Shadrick.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Recently got into the septic user arena.
Good for you.
Cabin.
Welcome aboard.
Pizza Trump.
Yeah.
It was a little bit of a little older, and so when it got really cold and there was no snow to insulate, part of the pipe froze. And so, luckily, it was later on, so we could reduce our use and get by. Is this type of system resistant to that?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry, I wouldn't say we have an advantage there. Those are often septic tank issues and the pipe that connects the tank to the drain field.
Right. This is, so, Mr. Chair, this is separate from that. There would be another pipe that connects to the infiltrator.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry, I also just moved from a trowel to a septic system up north. And what happens is there's a tank. There's a pipe from your house to the tank. There's a tank, and there's a pipe from the tank to the drain field. The freezing from what I've heard is those two pipes and the tank, And this is underground far enough that it would be very unusual for it to freeze.
Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Chaudhry. Those of us that have been using septic systems for a long time, you'll see straw, you know, covering. And if you don't, if you want to get away from rodent problems, you can use flax straw. Or now there's a company, I think, in northern Minnesota that manufactures, it's like a blanket almost that you can just roll out. And it does the same thing, and it's very easy. No mess in the spring to clean up, and it works great.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, I remember one of the pieces of advice I got when that happened was that put hay bales or straw over it to help. But this year there was plenty of snow, so I wasn't worried.
Ms. Sable, did you want to comment on Mr. Larson's testimony?
Mr. Chair, I did. Thank you. I would just like to let the committee know that by taking out the warrantied provision, we're not preventing use of these products. These products are high-quality products, and we endorse their use. We have a process, a separate process, in our new rules for doing that, and so we wanted to shift from the legislatively allowed process to the administrative process. And that's consistent with direction we got from the legislature in 2004, where we were directed to develop this process. So it's here now, and we want to use it.
On 9-1, we have an expiration date. Mm-hmm. Mr. Larson, that gives you some anxiety. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it does. It gives my clients and the other companies represented here some anxiety. We are working through issues with the PCA. We are not here to talk with you about that because we've committed to working with them over in Lafayette. To talk with them about that. That will be a statewide approval. The result of that will be advice to counties, and that will be the state with some advice from others, their opinion on the sizing that should be recommended for this. And we're working through that with them. It does give us some heartburn, though, because we believe this has worked well. We believe that counties should still be allowed to avail themselves of this. If they choose not to and instead depend solely on the state's recommendation that will be the result of our discussions, we are very unlikely as a company to push counties very hard on that. There are regulators locally. We tend to work very hard to get along with them. So we respectfully disagree with the agency only in that we'd like to keep this in place for counties that want to use it, not that they're going through a process. And it's a process that we are in the process of going through, and we are not here to complain to you at all about that process today.
But if we get to February 4th of 2010 and things haven't been resolved, then that option goes away? Is that?
Mr. Chair, if I could just give you a little bit of an example of what's happened in other states in a similar situation to this. Minnesota was typical of having this 40% reduction in a warranty. These companies went around the country in about the same time frame and got that adopted. More recently, these companies have gone back to those states and said, we'd like to get rid of the statutory or rule-based or guidance-based reduction of 40% in a warranty. We'd instead like to get rid of the warranty and reduce our sizing to maybe 20%. 30%, 15%. I've got various examples from my client. That would be a typical thing that my client and these other companies have seen in other states, and I wouldn't be surprised if that would happen here. It means that we'd have to predict the future, though, and I don't know if we're ready to do that today.
Senator Chaudhry, you looked like you were working up a question there.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, to either Senator Phoebe or witness, could it provide a hardship if this provision that they are concerned about is not in the bill? Would this unravel what you've been working on? Sounds like you're going to do some rules, and then if the rules, you end up doing rules and you adopt them and everything's smooth sailing, we could come back some other session and delete this as simply obsolete. If not, then the same warranty applies.
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, no, the world would fall apart. There's only about 2% of the systems that went in 2007 were warrantied systems, and so it's not a widely used phenomenon. Like I said, it's trying to clean up the statute and make sure that we pave the way for successful implementation. The rules are in place now. We are working through the process with people. A number of vendors are working with us now of different kinds of technologies, and that'll be a much easier process for the local governments to use. So I think that one of the ideas that we had talked about, and that was the other amendment, was if we're going to keep, well, and so if your intention were to keep this as a permanent piece of statute, we would wish to have some additional side rails put on this. Right now, it's a wide open door that anybody with money can drive through and say, my system is great for use in Minnesota. And because of the way this statute is structured, they don't have to prove anything works based on science. They just have to stand by it behind it financially. So we wanted to add some more longevity to it. We've talked about, I'm sorry. Okay. So I know this hasn't been moved yet, so we're just talking about this as a concept. The current warranty is 5 years. We aim our standard systems at a 30-year target. We don't ever say they're going to last 30 years, but that's what we go for. We make them larger than they need to be. We have backup capacity, and they have greater longevity than 5 years. 5 years really undercuts the expected lifetime of a system. And then the latter part of that piece of statute isn't how the system works. We don't permit individual systems, as that seems to imply. We would be issuing a warranty. And so we're issuing, you know, allowing the manufacturer to have a warranty. And so we suggest some changes to make it clear that we control the when the warranty happens based on science, and then also bring some of the other environmental protections that are in the rest of the statute that relate to septics into this. So it's not just about money. It's also about the environment. So those are the, if you want to keep this as a permanent piece, these would be things that we would like to see to help that become a more environmentally sound permanent piece of statute.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Larson.
Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Larson, what's your response to that?
Mr. Larson. Chair, Senator Chaudhry, I have a couple responses. One is this, we changed the law in 2001. It was in place in 1997, then it was repealed and a repealer in the special session in 2000. And then we came back and put it back in. And it's in a kind of an improved state. If you look on page 8, there were some provisions that were added when it was put back in that weren't in the rule at the time. And one you'll see on line 8.6, we were required, which was not at the case in 1997, we were required to bring to the agency documentation showing that a minimum of 50 of our systems had been installed and operated under normal use across all major soil classifications for a minimum of 3 years in order to qualify for this. So that was one hurdle that we had to get over, is it couldn't just be anybody coming in. This was part of the resolution that I think probably took place in this room, is that there was a hurdle that people wanted to put in the way. And one of them was that, is that you had to have 50 systems. They had to have been installed across all major classifications of soil, and they had to have been operating for 3 years. That was 2001, so those would now be 1998 systems. Another provision that we put in at the time, and to be honest with you, I suggested this, 8.31, and it says the commissioner may prohibit, without the new changes or with that, a subsurface sewage treatment system from qualifying for installation under this subdivision upon a finding of fraud, system failure, failure to meet warranty conditions, or failure to meet the requirements of this subdivision, or other matters that fail to meet the intent and purpose of this subdivision. Prohibition of an installation of that system does not alter the warranty obligations. The reason that we recommended that at the time is because we wanted to make sure that people didn't perceive us as being put in here permanently if our system wasn't working. So we wanted the commissioner to have the authority, which the commissioner has today, to take our classification as a warranted system away.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Sable, aren't those parameters in law almost better than the parameters? You know, your parameters were proactive, but these are kind of punitive. Aren't they those kind of a better deterrent to
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry, when I read Part F here at 8.31. I'm not certain that it says that we can affect the warranty. It says to me that we may prohibit a system, a septic system, from using this technology. But because we don't permit systems, they're done locally, we don't have any way to know that. And when I read this language, I'm not even sure that when it says we can prohibit installation of a system, if that would then go back if we found past problems and require those past problems to be corrected. And I'm not saying that your systems have past problems, because they have proven to be very good. The issue is longevity. Longevity is the concern we have.
Mr.
Larson.
Senator Chaudhry, just an additional response. I checked with my client about the national scene on warranties in this, because this is not in a Minnesota, a unique situation for Minnesota. Again, this type of thing happened at the same time frame in many states. Nowhere in the country is there a warranty that's longer than 5 years from the brief look that my client had to look at that this afternoon. So we don't have experience, and no other state has imposed that requirement. And we don't disagree with that idea that systems, if they're going to fail, probably last at least 5 years. We'll just say that right now. The 5-year warranty was specifically intended to help people when there were installation issues, when something happened right away, and that's a time when a system might fail. When you get too far out, our argument would probably be that there's a whole lot of things that might cause a system to fail that doesn't have anything to do with this plastic chamber that was used to install it. You've got people in the room that know a lot more than I do about failed systems, but what I've heard from my client is if you go out a ways, it's too much loading, it's people who don't know how to handle a septic system, it might be freezing, it might be an installation problem. So I guess long answer to say my client would be a little uncomfortable taking responsibility for all the failures that might occur over that period of time.
Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Chair, or Mr. Knopf, what's the amendment, the number of the amendment that Ms. Sable and Senator Fulby were referring to?
Mr. Knopf?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's a short one. You see, it's from the advisor's office. It's A09-0181. And that increases from 5 to 30 years on the warranty, the requirement.
Okay, I'm going to move.
Senator Chaudhry.
I'm going to move that amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
And then, we got to move on. And then maybe you guys can talk more about what's better, 5 or 30 or someplace in between.
Senator Stumpf?
Mr. Chairman.
To the amendment, or?
Yes, it's to the amendment. I'm just asking a question to see if I understand this correctly. The manufacturer has to have financial backing for the period of the warranty, and if you extend it out, let's say, to 30 years, that gets to be quite a cost on the manufacturer. If you have, 20,000 systems or however many thousand systems times the number of years times the cost of that system, we don't do that to any other installer or any other individual septic system. We have a traditional rock system where we have three traditional rock systems in our place, and none of them, if they would have failed within a period of a few years, we'd have to pick up the cost ourselves.
Mr. Larson, what's a better number?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, in answer to your question, five has been in place since 1997. No one's ever asked us before the time I've been sitting at this table right now to change that number. So I don't have an answer on behalf of anybody I'm representing.
Mr. Larson, now we have an amendment in front of us, but if we just deleted the sunset, at any time we could come back and change the statute again. Mm-hmm. And we could see if they're working. So if we took out 9.1, it would kind of be at our discretion then whether or not to change the statute down the road. give it some time to work or not. But we have Senator Chaudhry's 0180 in front of us, committee.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, I mean, what's better than 30 but more than 5? There's something that reasonable that it, and knowledgeable that we can insert in there instead of 30? Maybe Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, and just a comment. Just thinking from a business perspective, warranties are relatively, you know, shorter term, not, you know, like for, because the cost that the manufacturer has to bear is, you know, you have to add that to it. So you either would have to have a some kind of a security way, a secure way of backing that up, and I think this is really kind of unreasonable.
Mm-hmm. 30 years is.
Senator Chaudhry.
Yes, I think 30 years would be.
Is there something that's more reasonable?
Well, I don't have a problem with the current period, but, you know, my problem is that Ms. Sable, you mentioned that you have rules. Well, have the rules been in place, and are they operating?
Ms. Sable.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, the rules are in place, and they've been operating for a year. We're in the process of registering products right now. And so we're not completed the process. We have another year to complete the process. February 4th, 2010 is the end date. And so that was the... Mr. Chair, if I could address the longevity issue.
Sable.
We were talking with the other Mr. Larson earlier today, and he suggested 20 years might be a time frame. And to think about it, what they're warrantying is the sizing of the product. And so they're saying that at 40% less than a rock trench, this will last for a period of time. 5 years is easy. Mr. Larson may, the other Mr. Larson may want to talk to this. He said that when they find failures, they're in the 7 to 10 year range. We want to ensure that the people that put in these small systems have a fix. And the fix won't be putting in a new septic tank. It won't be a whole thing. It might be adding more drain field. And so if the small sizing didn't work during that period, more product would go into the ground, and it would be a larger system. So that would be the fix.
Well, let's just get rid of the sunset, and at some point we'll know when they start failing.
Mr. Chairman, my suggestion is to wait until the rules are completed and then remove the sunset provision, which would just be a year from now.
All right,
Senator.
So Mr. Chair, Senator Dill had his hand.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I've put in several septic systems, including one last fall that uses very same technology, and it's very quick and easy to do. I'm amazed at how fast it can be put in the ground. We were on sandy soil, and it was, I think it was only a $3,500 system, which is relatively inexpensive. But we had a lot of drain field that we used. It wasn't a real short system. But it went in really quickly. And even if it fails and you have to add some more of these pieces, it's very simple to do. A backhoe can make that trench, and they all hook together, and they flop. They're about 6 or 8 feet long, and they just go in there real quick and cover it up, and it's the expense is not that big. So I'm not even sure that this warranty thing, this idea of warranty, is really that critical, because the cost is not that high. You can't insure yourself for every loss in society or in your life. It gets too expensive to do that. You have to stand some risk yourself. And to me, the 5 years is long enough. One thing that I learned after we put this last system in is that if you don't start using it right away, you've got to watch out for gophers. They're going to fill up the system with dirt. And so I put some gopher bait in the system last fall because we weren't planning on using it.
We moved to divide it, and we can
so Mr. That's Chair.
Senator Fobey.
If I can recommend, it sounds like we need to back up a little bit and talk about the sunset piece and decide as a committee what we want to do with that, if we want to delete it or not. If not, then I don't think we have to address the rest. So that's what
Senator
I recommend
Chaudhry,
at
to
this
that point.
Point.
So then, Mr. Chair, I'll move to divide my own amendment between lines 2 and 3 and vote on the
right here.
On the second part first. This is
the third.
Sure.
So the amendment would only be lines 3. The first part of the amendment would only be lines 3 through 7 that we would vote on. That I believe that reinserts the warranty in. Is that correct?
Is that correct, Mr. Ganon?
I'm not sure.
Mr. Chairman, I think it does more than that, Senator Chaudhry. It amends the part that Mr. Larson referenced earlier down below on instead of installation, it's from qualifying for the warranty rather than for qualifying for installation. So it does change things a little bit in the way that the structure would work.
Okay.
Senator Chaudhry.
All right.
Senator
Phoebe?
If I can recommend, I believe that we need to back up and maybe even rescind your moving the amendment and back
too.
Up to dealing with the sunset provision.
Right. I'll withdraw the 0181.
Senator Chaudhry withdraws his amendment. Senator Phoebe.
I'm torn on this one because the sunset provision, there was an amendment that was brought to me late this afternoon that was asked to be considered.
Members, are you interested?
Yeah.
Senator Stump, we need to move.
Mr. Chairman, I had just moved to delete line 9.1, and then we can come back next year and deal with it. Then the rules will be in place and they'll be functioning.
Senator Stump moves to delete 9.1. Questions? To that amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Anyone else want to speak for or against this bill? Mr. Curry, I know that you at one point had indicated you might want to. Just come to the table, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm John Curry. I'm here to offer just a couple minutes of testimony as a private citizen. And if you bear with me, it's a short story. I promise you it'll be worth your while. And it's because the work of the septic policy person is often an unheralded profession. 8.5 years ago, my wife and I went camping at Wild River State Park, which is on the St. Croix River. And there is a tributary called the North Fork of the Sunrise River there. They were advertising that they had inner tubing, where you float along in a tube, and we thought it would be a great time for us. So we took this 3-year-old in her little floaties, and we went tubing on the Sunrise River. Later in the tent, she got a terrible fever, and it kept going higher and higher, so we decided it was time to abandon the weekend camping trip and drive to Regents Hospital. On the way back to Regents Hospital, she not only had this fever, she became completely listless in the little baby seat in the back seat of the car. By the time we got to Regents, she was no longer conscious. So when we got to the hospital, very quickly they put the right tubes and liquids and nutrients, and she came back throughout the course of the night, and the next day everything was fine. The doctor said that there was some bacteria that got in her somehow, and we just would never know what that was. So fast forward a couple years later, and you all are working on impaired waters, and we find out that the Sunrise River has excessive levels of fecal coliform bacteria. And there was people who were thinking that must have come from straight pipe septics. That's where you flush the toilet, no treatment, right into the river. And that would be a very obvious form of E. coli that had gotten into my daughter, and it would have affected a 3-year-old more than a big, fat old man. So flash forward a few years later than after that, and it's Monday of this week, and I'm reading what the good people along the Sunrise River are doing, and they have just completed an inventory of the entire watershed, 5,000 septic tanks, and they found just under 500 straight pipe septic tanks. So put that picture in your brain. My family's floating along 500 straight pipe septics. And think how many other Minnesota families experience something like that. The really good news now is the voters have approved money to clean up rivers like the Sunrise River. and the folks in the septic world are making incremental progress that you don't always see at any given committee hearing. But I wanted to let you know about that story because I think good things are happening.
Thank you, Mr. Curry.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Curry, I just literally this week went on the DNR website and called Wild River State Park to inquire about a canoe camping trip this summer. And perhaps I should wait a couple of years.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, I would do it upstream of the sunrise.
Thank you for that story. I appreciate it in more than one way.
You're welcome. Thank
you. Senator Phoebe moves Senate File 1449 as amended to be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. Questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Phoebe. Thank you to the witnesses and your patience. We'll move to Senate File 1655, ATV seizures. We're getting some information passed out. Senator Chaudhry, welcome to the other end of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill ratchets up penalties for certain ATV violations, riding violations. They center on the violations that we have in statute regarding impacts on the environment, wetlands in particular, and it creates the first penalty in the form of a forfeiture for being a wetland. It is the culmination, not recommendation, but culmination discussions that occurred over the interim, the working group, to examine how we could go about doing this type of thing, seizures, forfeitures of ATVs. And there was a lot of discussion. There weren't any formal recommendations from the working group, but the discussions on the intricacies of enforcement within the ATV world, DNR in general, were very, very enlightening. The way current law works is that most, if not all, of our ATV violations are misdemeanors. You receive a misdemeanor citation, and you pay a fine. In addition to that, there are some steps and lanes, depending on the number of offenses you've had, that invoke certain re-education efforts of the rider. And then there are some penalties on, I believe, registrations and allowing one to ride in the future. They're very, you have to offend a lot in order to have those happen to you. So even before a series of Star Tribune articles came out on the issue of ATV rider violations, this working group had begun the discussions. But this series of articles highlighted the impact that irresponsible riding has on the environment. And so that certainly increased the urgency figuring out what we can do to increase penalties, because there was agreement even amongst riding associations that the worst of the worst riders are giving the responsible riders a bad name and hurting the sport. A couple years ago, we worked on some ATV laws centered on establishing seasons and parameters of where you can ride. But one of the outstanding things that I said at that time and since is that one of the outstanding issues is the type of penalties we have on the on ATVs. And we need to start examining where we can increase, ratchet up our penalties. And so there's been lots of discussion. There have been bills in the past requiring forfeitures for a variety of violations. Those bills have never passed. But there continues to be the assertion, whether you're an ATV rider or environmentalist, that we've got to get at the bad actors for sure. And so what this bill does is propose that we begin to ratchet up our penalties on ATV violations on what we can for sure agree are violations that should result in someone's machine being forfeited. And then what violations we for sure agree should result in someone losing their riding privileges. Maybe not losing their machine, but at least losing their privileges. So the bill does two things. One, it creates a process for forfeiting an ATV for someone who violates a new penalty that we're creating in this bill. And that is the recklessly upsetting the ecological balance of a wetland. It is a step up from the current law, which is carelessly upsetting the ecological balance of a wetland. So we are adding a new standard. For that new standard, recklessly upsetting the balance of a wetland, we are saying that that will be a gross misdemeanor, not just a misdemeanor, but a gross misdemeanor, that whose conviction will result in a forfeiture of a vehicle. And the process then we institute for forfeiture mirrors what we have for DWIs. It's pretty simple, and the language we have in the bill for that forfeiture was just basically lifted from the DWI statute in consultation with the Judiciary Committee's counsel. In fact, Mr. Bacchus with the Crime Committee and Judiciary Committee was involved in some of the discussions this interim, and he actually was very, very helpful on what some of the things that the Crime Committee would consider in new penalties and how we work current forfeiture laws. That's the main piece of the bill. There were concerns about simply applying the forfeiture law to the carelessly upsetting a wetland. There may be instances where someone, for some reason, accidentally upsets the balance. Not sure about that, but I didn't want, when we're creating a forfeiture and we're coming at this with the intent of getting at the bad actors, I didn't want to risk somehow someone who perhaps didn't deserve to have their sled, truly deserved to have their machine forfeited, to have that, and then us coming back and scaling back the law. I wanted to make it dead solid that we know that this standard, if violated, no one can disagree that they should have their machine taken away. That's why we've created this reckless standard.
Senator Chaudhry, was there any discussion, you speak specifically to wetlands. If I put in a couple thousand trees around my property and someone jumps off the road when they're coming by and runs down 200-300 of them, could we go get their machine?
Mr. Chair, no, not under this bill.
Okay.
What we do under this bill is the second piece, and that is for violating the carelessly upsetting a wetland, for intentionally riding in a WMA or an SNA or a state park, or for recklessly disregarding a person's safety or property. This goes to your tree issue. Those three additional violations would result in riding privileges being removed for a year. So no, that doesn't result in forfeiture, but it would result in riding privileges being removed. We've gone back and forth in internal discussions. Yeah, that's too harsh. That's not too harsh. But I think what the consensus feeling is, at least in my discussions and my understanding, is that we need to start ratcheting up. Number two, we feel that the main purpose and result of this law will be largely deterrent in nature. That, number one, it will be now known that there's a situation that can occur where your machine can be forfeited. And number two, there seems to be an understanding or agreement that it's only going to take a handful, even a less than a handful, of machines being forfeited for word to get around real quick that you need to stay on the trail. You need to stay on the trail. And that's the simple aim of this bill. And so that's where we came up with this. There were lots of internal discussions with both sides of the issue, with Senate counsel and research, and this is what we honed it down to. I just think that we've tried to ratchet up penalties in the past. There have been disagreements, and nothing's got done. The worst of the worst actors are still out there hurting the environment. So let's get something passed that we all agree on, that is rational, that is focused on the problem, and go from there.
Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Chaudhry, I think that what you have here is the beginnings of something good. I, using the analogy as you have of in discussions of DWIs, the question arises, with a DWI, if you have a gross misdemeanor and you have a forfeiture on the first on your first violation, normally in a DWI you don't forfeit your vehicle on the first violation. You know, that would be at least the second violation. I don't even know if it's it has to be a felony or whatever. But one would wonder, you know, maybe think about the forfeiture being on the second violation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxog, that was a consideration as well. First of all, just to clarify, you can have your vehicle forfeited on a first violation intent in a DWI if there are aggravating factors involved.
And generally, it would be a felony, or
it wouldn't be a felony. It would still be a gross misdemeanor, but it would still be subject to forfeiture. Let's say if you were over .20. And there was a kid in the car. Even though that's your first, it could be it can result in forfeiture. And by the way, you can have your vehicle forfeited even before you're convicted. Under DWI, this doesn't go that far. This just says you do have to be convicted of this, and then forfeiture proceedings can begin. I think I went back and forth on the first and second issue, multiple violations issue. And the reason I settled on the first is because under the last year, for example, there were only about 15 wetland violations that were cited under the carelessly upset the ecological balance. So out of a total of around 200 total ATV citations, there were 15 of them that were wetland related. And so I didn't think that we were capturing that many, for one. And then secondly, we ratcheted up, we applied the forfeiture to an even higher standard. So if you were to extrapolate, there would probably be there would be no more than 15 under this new standard, probably much less. But remember, our goal is to get the worst of the worst, number one, and get that word out there real quick that you could have your violation, that you could have your machine taken away. If you remember from those articles over the interim, the one violator who had three wetland violations said, "I don't know what the big deal is. I don't know. I don't think this is a problem. Why am I being cited for this?" And it was outrageous. So, I mean, out of 15 first-time and multiple violations, I think if we clearly create a standard where we absolutely know you recklessly upset the ecological balance of a wetland, you should have your machine taken away and your privileges suspended for a year.
Follow-up.
Now,
I'm sorry, Senator Shot.
Now, if you're and I don't think you can get anyone under that standard other than the worst of the worst. If it was an accident, if it truly was an accident, the worst case scenario for that person would be a careless.
Follow up. Senator Saxon.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Senator Chaudhry, I'm sure you and I can go around and around about this, but we are going from a petty misdemeanor, to a gross misdemeanor with a year, taking a year off there, plus we're going to go to a forfeiture. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, that the first time around, a gross misdemeanor and taking it away for a year, and then the next time that happens, or if it does happen, that we take the makes more sense. Yeah. But we can.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the difference between careless and reckless. Being in the business for a long time, reckless is being intentional, more intentional. And that is more serious because now we've got a willful act here that they're going out to do some damage. Who is going to determine whether it goes to the misdemeanor step? You've got that described in here. Who's going to determine that? If in fact it was it's still a careless in nature, and there was an awful lot of damage that was dug up. And you know, now we're not talking just four wheeler ATVs here. We're talking pickups too, $38,000 vehicles. Is the CEO the one that determines that is a willful, wanton disregard? I mean, how do you determine that?
Senator Shatter.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it would be the current process that we have today where either the CEO writes the citation then and there, or he writes a report and submits it to the county attorney, and then the county attorney files a formal complaint against that person given the facts of the case. This would not be different. Remember, the gross misdemeanor is only for the new reckless standard for upsetting a wetland. Under current law, there is a process for where the DNR determines what the damage is, what the restitution is, repayment. And it does happen. Not a lot, but it does happen. And so it would be the same process, except the CO or the county attorney would make the determination that this guy was in the wetland, off the trail, clearly not exercising their hunting exception. It was clearly not careless because, you know, and this was completely reckless, like the guy in the Star Tribune article who has been caught three times. And then the trier of fact ultimately determines whether it was reckless. It's the same as when the trier of fact determines whether it was careless or whether it upset the ecological balance. That's another point to make. Remember, it's not just about carelessly being in a wetland or recklessly being in a wetland. It is carelessly or recklessly upsetting the ecological balance of the wetland. So if you accidentally go off and your tire hits a wetland off the trail and there's no impact, you haven't violated the law. Because there has to actually be an impact.
Follow up?
Yeah, so getting stuck in a WMA with a pickup and just sitting there grinding and grinding the wheels, and that WMA is 15, 20 acres. Big. That would upset the balance of the ecological system in that WMA.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I don't know. It's all on the actual impact. And what happens, what we learned is that someone from the DNR goes out and figures out if there was an actual, real upsetting of the ecological balance. That happens. I can't tell you. Maybe he was spinning his tires and it didn't do anything permanent or upset the flow of the hydrology or whatever. But those are all circumstance-based, and that's for the CO to look at and say, well, this was clearly upsetting it. From my knowledge, I'm going to cite him with that. And then it's his determination whether it was careless or reckless.
Senator, follow up again?
Just
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Just following through the process here and having been there before. So the CO is going to have to make an awful lot of determination on site in order to repossess or to take charge of that vehicle.
Senator Chaudhry.
Is he going to come out later and say, yes, this really was very reckless, intentional? I probably should have taken his ATV, but he's got it at home. I'm going to have to go out and get it now from his home, and guess what? And all of a sudden that's gone. I mean, I see that happen.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, no, that could not happen under this bill because it requires the conviction of that before the forfeiture process is invoked.
Not taking it right away.
Right.
Senator Chaudhry, we've got three witnesses that would like to come to the table. Ken Irish.
Do we have Jack Larimore?
Good evening, Mr. Irish. Thanks for your patience. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ken Irish. I'm the president of the All Terrain Vehicle Association of Minnesota. First of all, I want to thank Senator Chaudhry. I commend his efforts for taking this issue head on. It's a very controversial issue when you start talking forfeiture and seizure of somebody's personal property. I think it extends a little beyond just that. It goes into people's personal lives, too, and families. But also, I understand that something needs to be done to deter these people that are willfully damaging wetlands out there. And we need to send a strong message out there that this is not going to be tolerated in this state, that if you're going to continue this type of behavior, there is a penalty. And if the penalty resolves that you lose your ATV or that you lose your privilege for a year or you're severely fined, I mean, I think those are the lasting impressions that will deter people from continuing that type of behavior. When we were discussing this issue with our lobbyists and stuff, we have some concerns with the bill also, that as the bill now has a lot of merit and intent is going in the right direction, is it years later, could there be more amendments made to the bill that if somebody was going off trail like you were described, they're out deer hunting and they got off trail and their truck is stuck and they're trying to get out and they're rutting back and forth, and their kid gets caught without a safety training certificate or a helmet, would these things eventually lead to a first, second, third offense where they would have their ATV or maybe their truck taken away from them? So I'm also sitting here looking for some direction and some open discussion from the committee here as to how can we work this bill and craft it so that it does the intent that it will hopefully stop those people from doing this type of behavior. So with that, if you've got some questions, I
comments or questions for Mr. Irish? Mr. Irish, I think although we're breaking some new ground, I think it's still a work in progress to some extent, and I think there will be discussions moving forward about things that are working and things that need to be improved on.
And in our internal discussions, Mr. Chair, members, you know, and Mr. Irish, you know, raised the same concern with me. And I think he has, I think his concerns are fair. What I'm hearing is that they agree with the contents of the bill, but want to make sure that some of the things we've seen in the past, this doesn't open the door to some of the things that they disagreed with in the past. And, you know, we had a long discussion about it. You know, first of all, I reminded him that those other things that were introduced in the past didn't happen. But also, you know, there may be times when ATVAM themselves feel should also be forfeited. Those are just the unknowns of the future. But they do know that there are certain things that are not clearly warranted for a forfeiture. And I agree. The items that he cited, I would not support as a forfeiture. But I may not be here in the future, and their, you know, their concerns are legitimate. And at the very least, it's important for them to say on the record that you know, it's important to get at the worst of the worst, and send the message that we're not going to let some rogue riders give the rest of the sport a bad name.
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry, this seems awfully punitive, and especially on the first-time violation, and I do appreciate your efforts for deterrence, and I'm not sure that first-time violations with severe ticketing and warning that future problems and your machine is gone isn't as good a deterrent as the initial taking on a first offense. So I have issues with that, I think, and I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know if careless and reckless, isn't that some gray area in between that leaves it up to subjective judgment, and that makes me a little nervous there, because it depends on who sees you then as to whether or not you're going to get your machine taken away. I don't know how you clarify that. Once again, I'm not a lawyer, so. But that's one of those things that I like the direction it's going. I'm just not sure that I could support it the way it is now, and I'm wondering if we can't work on it just a little more to get it. Not sure if it's as timely as if this is as timely an issue as to get it done right away.
Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, we need, this is an outstanding issue in the whole ATV public policy discussion. It's the bane of both sides. They want to get something done. Here's why I came up with the first offense. If there were, out of 200 ATV odd violations, there were 50, 75 wetland violations. I would certainly be inclined to say, let's rank it. Second offense, maybe even third offense, multiple violators. But even just for the carelessly upsetting a wetland, we're only talking about 15 max. In fact, I think it was like 13 or 14 violations last year. So if we're going to wait for a second offense, very few of those were multiple violations anyway. And in addition to that, even if there were a multiple violation, let's say it was a second offense and it was careless but not reckless, you're ending up taking their machine away for what is arguably, which would be a situation that is at least debatable. So what I'd rather do is create the standard where we know that we do not want that behavior. And we cannot disagree. And there's no reason not to take their machine. There just isn't.
Senator Saxog?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Chaudhry, how are you thinking about proceeding with this particular bill? I mean, do you want us? I mean, obviously, what we're talking about is first or second is going to be kind of the crux. I don't think anybody disagrees that we want to get tougher on ATV violations. So, do you want to wait till a different? Do you want to do that tonight, or what do you want to do?
Mr. Chair, if the policy committee really wants to change it, I would say do it now because they would, and I would not support that.
Yeah.
This has been a carefully crafted, narrowly focused bill after a lot of discussions. But we do have to go to judiciary. So if you're not on judiciary, then this would be your crack at it, I guess. But I really think that the principles that we have on here are very sound. We're only talking about a maximum sphere of 15 violators under the careless standard, but we're only applying the forfeiture to a new, higher reckless standard. That's going to be far fewer. And so to say that, well, if you recklessly upset the balance of a wetland for the second time, you know, why did we wait until the second time or the third time? That wouldn't make sense. For a careless, I can maybe understand. But then again, let's say it was somehow an accident and you were careless. I don't think you should have your sled, your machine taken away on the second offense necessarily. It depends on the situation. Here we're creating a standard where it's for sure. We know you should take your machine away and, you know, let's just do it. So that we can get these bad people, bad actors, off the trail.
Mr. Irish, if you prefer, you could leave the table unless you wanted to.
Well, we have some more witnesses. Yeah. Let's go through those.
And I've got three.
And then if someone is thinking of an amendment, that'll give them time to get the verbiage.
Senator Phoebe, did you have a question?
Well, I just want to weigh in a little bit, Mr. Chair, and I'm thinking about how I want to say this. I am an ATV owner, and I have three young adult sons, and I live right on wetlands and lakes and near the Sherburn Wildlife Refuge, and my sons have been stuck so many times, and I think of situations that you're talking about, and it just feels severe that if someone, and they've been stopped, and people have walked to my house, DNR and whatever, have said, ooh, this was rough. And so it feels severe to me. And I...
Mr. Chair, Senator Phoebe, it would be severe. Right? In your situation, it would be severe to forfeit a machine for that because they were carelessly in there. And that's why we didn't want to get into the forfeiture for a careless violation. And that's why we intentionally separated that out. Now, if your sons were in that wetland, not just stuck, but they were being reckless, vroom, vroom, circling, let's get all muddied up, and it was in the Sherburn Refuge, you know, I think that's reckless, and I think I think the penalty we have in this bill is appropriate. But let me just say that when we're considering the what-ifs, remember, we're talking about a sphere of 13 or 14 total wetland violations last year under the careless standard. Most of those probably happened, did not occur in a citation because of the experience with your sons.
Senator Kelash. I'm sorry, Senator Chaudhry. Senator Kelash?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sodge, I appreciate your deterrence. I'm just feeling sorry for the poor bugger that's first up because he's going to get his machine taken away and won't know that anybody else has had their machine or that it's even a violation. You're looking to grab a couple of machines so the publicity gets out there and it's a deterrent, but for those first guys up, it seems a little bit like I said, it still seems punitive, and I'm not sure why a second violation where the word gets out that you now have a violation next time around you're getting a machine isn't as big a deterrent, except for the fact that it may not get the message to the community as fast, but it will still get there. So it's like we're eliminating a warning system or something. So that's one of my issues with it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry. A person who violates this new standard will not be considered a poor bugger.
Mm-hmm. He hasn't been forewarned that he could lose his machine, my point, or it's going to be difficult to.
Mr. Chair, there will be plenty of forewarning because we have our laws. We do that in every other area of game and fish laws. There's new rules. We do that with our DWI laws. And the standard is appropriate. It's appropriate.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, and then we're going to go to the testimony.
I just want to make a comment, maybe a question, but I remember last year, Senator Chaudhry, we talked about signage, I think, doing a better job of signage because they were coming along, and if the signs aren't there, it's almost like a license to go off in the wherever. So I thought we addressed signage last year, and that's why I'm wondering if that amount of violations would have happened since. Is this over the last year, you're saying, 15 violations, or is it over a longer period of time? 2008.
I apologize. Is it Mr. Umphress? Is that right?
Yep, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Umphress.
Welcome.
I do represent the Amateur Riders Motorcycle Association of Minnesota. And I would, again, like to thank Senator Chaudhry for his working through this and with us and taking a contentious issue and trying to come up with a solution that is heading in the right direction. I will also agree with Senator Chaudhry in that these people are not doing the average recreationalist any favor when they're out there and destroying these wetlands or recklessly engaging in activities out there they should not be doing. So I think we are heading in the right direction there. I would like to point out, because we keep mentioning the word ATV, then there was reference here earlier, but this bill is a lot broader than just ATVs. It is all of the OHV environment or machines, and I know we know that, but we keep using the term ATV, and I want to make sure everybody understands that this is affecting motorcycles and trucks as well.
I say machine.
Yeah. So with that said, there are a couple things in here that I would like to just kind of point out that are of a little bit of concern to me. One is on line 118, and the same thing on line 121, on the loss of privilege to operate for a year. It looks like it says if they violate the prohibition on the act, but it doesn't say they have to be convicted of it. So I'm wondering if that's...
Mr. Knopf, a clarification there? Well,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry has a technical amendment to this that would clarify that.
Clear that up. We're going to get to that one, Mr. Umphress.
That sounds like a good plan to me.
Okay.
Another part I would just like to point out to everybody as well, too, is that I think it was a couple of years ago now, there was legislation passed, new statute out there, that when a violator is convicted of any offense, failure to display registration, things like that, they have to go through the education program, and they're not allowed to operate their machine until they have successfully passed the rider operation courses that mm-hmm. exist out there today. So if it takes them 10 years to do that, they've got 10 years where they can't operate their machine on the land. So we do have some prohibitions out there today that affect that that language. And Senator Chaudhry, before I bring it up here, I know we talked also the other day about some of the technical stuff in the bill.
Yeah, we got that.
Looks like he's going to take care of that stuff as well. So. But again, I think it's a step in the right direction. I always get a little concerned when we're talking about personal property. There was a mention of, somebody taking a truck out there, and as somebody who's looking to need a bigger vehicle for towing stuff, I would hate to lose a $50,000 truck because I accidentally drove in the wrong direction. But it's the right direction, and I really do commend Senator Chaudhry and the committee for the new tone over the last few years. It's been a lot nicer to be able to work with you guys to come up with solutions to issues that are important to all of us, because none of us want to see our environment become damaged out there. We all enjoy it. The reason we're out there and involved in this recreation usually is because it gets us out there with our families and we can enjoy the environment that exists.
Questions for Mr. Humphreys. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. I'm just thinking as we go here, now you're talking about a motorcycle, dirt bike, I guess we would say, machine. Is it going to be, it's going to certainly be a little harder for the CO to be able to prove the amount of damage. I mean, you're going to have to do a lot more damage to the same amount of damage as a pickup or even a four-wheeler ATV. So I'm trying to get that in my mind as to when it's going to be the part there where this bill will take away your motorcycle. In other words, you can do a lot more riding before you do as much damage as a $50,000 pickup.
Comment or
whatever that's worth.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shadrick, that's appropriate.
Yeah.
If it's harder to upset the ecological balance of a wetland with a motorcycle, then it should be harder to prove that you did that.
Right.
Mr. Larson, would you like to weigh in before we take the amendment?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dan Larson. Today representing the Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association. 90% of our members drive Jeeps, just so you get the mental image. And our group is probably the most misunderstood of the three OHV practices. So we received the language that holds the potential for seizure yesterday. And as you can guess, it caused a little bit of a commotion within our group. We've had a little time to look it over, but in the end, I was directed not to oppose this bill at this time, but was urged to, but the group wanted me to urge the committee to move with extreme caution when the topic is seizure of personal property. So it is not for the membership of the Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association that I am mostly concerned with, or that the organization is mostly concerned with. Our organization is well-informed, understands how to ride responsibly, and both socially, environmentally, and it is for others. We spend a lot of time in the woods talking to people that have no clue on how to ride responsibly, on how to abide by, on what the laws are, even where to go. There is a lot of confusion, I think, has been witnessed by some of the comments that we've even heard today. So not only on how to ride on public lands, but even on how to ride on your own lands, on private lands. So very concerned about that aspect of it. For those of you that don't know, our group likes to trail ride, for the most part, through the woods. We are the slowest of all of the OHV categories, usually between 3 and 5 miles an hour. So some like a greater challenge, like say that you could find at the Gilbert site where you climb rocks and whatnot. At any rate, the concern in the bill, just to reiterate, is for the guy that is out watching birds, maybe out picking mushrooms or hunting, and decides to go off trail, makes a bad decision. He gets caught. The CO, maybe having a bad day, decides to exercise his authority. And the guy's pickup is paid for, or mostly paid for, and suddenly the state owns his pickup. This is something I think we've heard a little discussion about tonight, but that is a concern of the group. So with that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Larson, just for clarification, staff, was what organization do you technically represent?
Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Larson? Thank you. And I believe Jack Larimore would like to come to the table yet,
Gene,
too.
Gene,
I'm sorry.
Jack Pine Coalition.
Jack Pine Coalition. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My brother, your constituent, is Lee Larimore. My name is Gene Larimore, and I'm with the Jack Pine Coalition, which is part of a cluster of groups, including the Isaac Walt League, League of Women Voters, Audubon, Minnesota, and Sierra Club, who work weekly, if not daily, on these kinds of issues. If you consult your MEP briefing book, you'll see probably 15 or 20 organizations that support our efforts. As part of the Jack Pine Coalition, which is a movement of people in north central Minnesota who are concerned about appropriate management of ATV, we fully support this bill. We had worked on and discussed with Senator Chaudhry a more severe bill. Nonetheless, we thought, and I thought in particular, it was important to get this concept into law. I've been going to meetings and having discussions about managing ATV traffic for almost 10 years. Every one of those meetings talks about law enforcement. Everyone. And the COs have been hamstrung without that the tool of confiscation in their toolbox. This would provide them that. The bill is about changing behavior. It's not about collecting machines, nobody's interested. The whole confiscation and forfeiture process is a legal process. You can get a lawyer. These things have to be proven. So some of the comments I've heard from committee members I thought was a little over the top. And you are in court. The whole forfeiture process, you're in court. The enforcement division reputation, as long as I've been in Minnesota, and I was born here, well-trained and well-led. They know the difference between running off the trail into a puddle and severely damage the wetland. They continue to show a very high level of professionalism. The bill also gets at the attitude, which I hear even here tonight, that, well, boys will be boys. No offense, Senator. But boys will be boys are wrecking wetlands. And that attitude of, well, give them another chance has gotten us to this point. If we had this bill 10 years ago, we might not be having some of the problems we have here tonight. So any questions you might have, I would certainly...
Questions for Gene and Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, what was the more severe bill? Was that have the death penalty in it?
Well, at the last minute, Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, at the last minute, we took out capital punishment.
Wait a minute. Welcome to the committee. Did you want to also weigh in?
Could we revisit that? No.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kevin Preschult. I'm the Wilderness and Public Lands Director for the Isaac Walton League of America, a nonprofit conservation organization. And I just wanted to take a few moments to add our organization's support for Senator Chaudhry's bill. Like Gene, our organization has also been working to try to provide better enforcement tools to the DNR for OHV violations over the last number of years, and we have supported confiscation and forfeiture legislation in the past. So we're very supportive of Senator Chaudhry's work and of this bill, and we would urge you to adopt it. Just as one little anecdote, we talk about trying to get the worst of the worst. And one of the reasons why this is so important is that for those worst of the worst, monetary fines don't do the trick. For a lot of those folks, a fine is just part of doing business of their the way they operate their machines. And you see these anecdotal reports coming out of the conservation officer reports of they have stopped the same person three times in a day for doing the same thing. And so these, in the worst of the worst cases, I don't believe that the monetary fines alone are sufficient to provide the deterrent that we're looking for. And that's why we support Senator Chaudhry's work on CSER and forfeiture. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And Mr. Larimore, one last comment.
Just two more things. on the signage issue, Senator Ingebrigtsen, in managed forests, and most of our forests are classified managed, that means you can go on any trail that's not posted closed. There's no way you can sign in those in most of our state forests.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yeah, just a follow-up. I know we talked about that last year an awful lot here, or maybe it was a year before. I know something.
They blend together, don't they? the years.
Are there other witnesses?
Anybody else want to speak for or against? Otherwise, Senator Chaudhry, we need the amendment.
The A1, and then we just need to make sure we got that conviction thing taken care of.
Senator Chaudhry moves the A1. Questions, comments regarding the A1? It's before you. Members, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We have the A1.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Knopf, was that conviction issue taken care of by this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, yes.
Mr. Knopf.
If you look on, I did is just put in the new Section 1, and for 2, 3, and 4, clauses 2, 3, and 4, this is convicted of or subject to a final order under Section 84.775. That's the civil citation. So for each of those ones that were mentioned earlier by Mr. Umpress, that would, I think, take care of his concern. And there also, you can see down below, there were some changes in the back of the bill dealing with proof of insurance, which is not required for off-highway vehicles.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Chaudhry, maybe even legal counsel, can you... Obviously, there's some folks having trouble with this bill, punitive to overreaching, whatever. But can we go through the penalties again, the fines? I mean, there was just discussion about fines don't do any good. What is a gross misdemeanor first time around fine cost? I don't remember now. I've been away from it too long. Can somebody take me through that? What a misdemeanor, pretty misdemeanor.
The ranking of the fines are... petty misdemeanor, fine only. Misdemeanor.
What's the fine? Up to 100?
Oh, God.
Dollar amounts?
Up
to 1,000.
Petty misdemeanors?
Petty misdemeanors up to 300.
Yeah. Up to $300. Mm-hmm. Misdemeanor is between, the fine is $300 to $1,000. Is that correct, Mr. Knopf?
I'm fine.
We're going to
look
that.
It up. Members.
Gross misdemeanor, it's 1 to 5,000. But we'll just.
Two, I think.
Well, why don't we?
I'd
just
be interested.
Why don't I instead of?
Let's just take.
Mr. Chairman, I can.
Trying to show off my law school education.
Yeah. Well, it's almost 9:30, so.
Mr. Chairman, it's 609.03, which basically, unless it's otherwise specified, you can't specify the length of time and fines within the statute that. Creates the crime, but if it's not otherwise specified, if a crime is a gross misdemeanor to imprison of not more than 1 year or payment of a fine of not more than $3,000, if the crime is a misdemeanor to imprisonment of not more than 90 days or payment of a fine of not more than $1,000, and if the crime is other than a misdemeanor and a fine is imposed but the amount is not specified, the payment fine of not more than $1,000 or imprisonment for a specified. Well, I guess that one wouldn't really apply. Petty misdemeanors not in here because they're not considered a crime.
Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of observations. It seems like the definitions of upset the natural and ecological balance. It seems there's no definition for that. So it would be up to somebody to say that this is upsetting the natural or ecological balance. So I see that as some potential for a lot of high-priced attorneys in court. Because I think what I have envisioned is that there's a lot of ditch riding you know, alongside the highways and stuff. And normally that's, you know, there's ruts from the ATVs, multiple ATVs, many different riders going through. So let's say the law enforcement person comes along, and a lot of that's in wetlands because it's there's no definition. The definition you have for wetlands picks up everything. So it's a very broad brush. So you have these traditional places where people are riding, and then somebody comes along and says, oh, there's somebody riding, and stops that person and takes a picture of those ruts and says, you know, you are subject to this law, and you're upsetting the wetlands because look at these ruts. So how we, the defense, I suppose, well, it would go to court. The defense would be, well, I didn't cause all those ruts myself. And the prosecution would say, oh, yes, I caught you there. Here's the picture. Here's your ATV. I mean, how do we resolve some of those those issues that are more complex than?
Senator Chaudhry.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, I think, first of all, it's an excellent observation on the ditch, because we did discuss the ditch issue as well, and that was one of, that was another reason why we didn't want the forfeiture to result from a careless upsetting of a wetland, because there are instances where people have gotten that tag for being in the ditch, and of course, it's illegal to be on the road, so they had no choice. And so that was another reason why we went up to the reckless standard. Under this new standard, you would have, first of all, have to be reckless. You would have to, and you would have to upset the ecological balance of the wetland. So you have to prove not only that the person was not only there, but you have to prove that they were there recklessly, not by accident. And by the way, not even by intent, but recklessly in there. And then you have to show that the ecological balance of the ditch was upset. And only then do you get your machine taken away. It's a pretty darn high standard that we're setting. And what has happened with the 15 previous violations for the careless is that there's some sort of DNR valuation of what it's going to take to restore it. Now, if the DNR is seeking to restore a ditch, I think we have bigger problems. Now, if there's maybe if it's a high-value wetland, it happens to be in a ditch, maybe. But in that case, that person would get no more than a careless and would have to contribute to the restoration. And they would not have their machine forfeited. We were very deliberate in what situations we wanted to capture in this situation.
And members, I think we're getting bogged down a little bit in verbiage, but Senator Stump, follow up.
Mr. Chairman, and I just want to put this on the record because obviously there's about four Senate members that represent over a third of the state, and in that third of the state, we have probably maybe 75-80% of all the publicly owned lands. And so you have conflicts that are ongoing right now between the DNR and the local residents over what is or is not a wildlife area. You know, like I think the DNR is in court over what the county is saying is a road. Has been road, it's been documented and whatever. So you have local residents, when the DNR puts a barrier up, they take the barrier down and they drive on the road. to me, that would be reckless, I think, very intentional. It may or may not hurt the wildlife area, but to me, I see lots of potential for mischief, probably on both sides.
Senator Sachs, are you going to help
Chair,
us?
Senator Stump, the reason,
Senator Chaudhry.
And we do this, you know, we do this with game and fish laws, we do it with crime laws. The reason why I felt comfortable doing this is because we're starting with the standard of only 15 people were cited with the careless in 2008 anyway. So if we're creating a much higher standard, I fail to see how there's going to be mischief if there wasn't a lot of mischief for the lower standard in the first place. So that's why I was pretty comfortable coming forward with this. And just, you know, finally, if you think back 2-3 years ago to the state of our ATV policy debates, and what we did 2 years ago we started with the MAP trail provision, and we had people who wouldn't sit at the same table together, let alone agree with what the other side was saying, for right or wrong. If it was them, we're against it. So fast forward to last year, we're working on some other ATV stuff, and then we have Mr. Bone and Mr. Botzik with the Audubon Society, the lobbyists, sitting at the same table on some of the unrefunded gas tax issue. And now this year, we actually have the heads of the organizations of the riders and the environmentalists actually sitting at the same table testifying in favor of a bill on ATVs. Think of how far we've come. And I think when you have that type of agreement between both sides on this issue, particularly for those of us who recall the acrimony, to put it mildly, I think we have leaps and bounds in honing in on what we rationally need to do to address some of these ATV issues. I submit to you it's a minor miracle.
Senator Sachs,
it was my goal that someday this was going to happen. I honestly didn't think it would happen so soon. So I think, and this is such a difficult needle to thread. And I think we have what we need here.
We're going to try a new voice. Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to first commend Senator Chaudhry for the work he's done, but say he's about to lose a vote if you don't move this along for a vote here.
Okay.
Because I it's getting pretty late, and I think we've heard extensive testimony.
Senator Saxar, do you have a door to get us out of here?
Well, I do. On page 2, line 2.10, I would move that oral amendment that under designated offense means A, and then insert second gross misdemeanor violation.
Mr. Knopf, is that on page 2, line?
Page 2, line 2.10. And insert the word second after, between A and gross.
Wait, are you on the,
I might be on somebody else's bill even. Is it tomorrow yet? No, just a second. 2.10. Thank you, Senator Saxog. I see it now. Does everybody understand the amendment? Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Chair, I'd ask members not to support the amendment. I appreciate where Senator Saxog is coming from, but the reason we created this higher standard is for the first offense. If we're going to forfeit machines, I would just assume do it on multiple offenses of the current law. But we created this reckless standard much higher so that we could get at the worst of the worst. And I think we've got it where we want it.
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, is this need to go through judiciary yet? Mr. Chair, I can support this with this particular amendment and move it on to judiciary, where I think there's a lot of this discussion needs to take place anyway. So,
we have an amendment before us. Mr. Knopf, would you just repeat it for me?
Mr. Chairman, on page 2, line 2.10, before gross, insert second.
Any other questions? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
To be clear, thank you, Mr. Chair. To be clear, then, Mr. Knopf, then it's going to take the second gross misdemeanor before we have a forfeiture.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, that's right. The gross misdemeanor would apply to the first offense, but forfeiture would not apply until the second offense, the second gross misdemeanor offense.
Thank you.
Other comments? To the amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Motion does not prevail.
I'll move.
I like a division of the House.
Division's been called. All those who voted in favor of the amendment, raise your hand. All those opposed? Chairman had poor hearing. The amendment does prevail, 5-4.
I'll move the bill as amended.
Senator Chaudhry, where do you want? This goes to judiciary. Senator Chaudhry moves Senate File 1655 as amended to be recommended to pass and to be re-referred to Judiciary Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Oh.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Thank Chair, you. Members. Oh.
Thank you, and thank you all for your patience.
I don't think that's
you've been here.
Tell me if I pay a $3,000 fine or $1,000.
Excuse you, lose.
Sucker, man.
Well, it's going to be tied up for a while.
The kid's not going to get the ATV anyway, right?
We should just go get him for voting.
Yeah. You should have.
So, no, really?
Talk to more of the members and educate them more.
Well, I mean, she said it was going slow enough.